first title fight in a fight night since 2020. It's UFC Noche from Las Vegas this week. Some big time fights, including that rematch in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. And just like that, we're back and getting set for another big week of fights. As always, one half of your host duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, no, it's not Tua Tagovailoa, Matt Allen, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP, and look at it. I mean, the first title fight in a Fight Night main event since Figueiredo versus Benavidez, number two, that was back in 2020. And this is going to be the first Fight Night ever at T-Mobile Arena, the first non-pay-per-view UFC card at T-Mobile, if you don't look at the Ultimate Fighter Redemption back in 2017.
Easy to overlook.
A big time deal, because you look at it, Mexican Independence Day, and what says Mexican Independence Day like a Fight Night card in Las Vegas, Nevada? I know, it's wild, but
Canelo fights there for his Mexican Independence Day fights. Well, it's a tradition now.
He doesn't get it this time, and if you do look at it, that main event, Grasso versus Shevchenko, in their first fight, it was Shevchenko winning two of the first three rounds. Grasso on a little bit of a spin from Shevchenko, grabs the back, gets her a naked choke, and it's all over. But you look up and down this card, five total fighters representing just Mexico as it is, many Mexican-Americans on this card as well, and a lot to look forward to with some of these prospects, some high-flying action-type prospects on this card.
There's a lot of really well-matched fights up and down this whole entire card, and I think it's an exciting one. It's too bad that they have gone so long without having a title fight on one of these Fight Night cards, because I think it's always a good way to just promote whatever title that might not really be worthy of getting a main event of a pay-per-view, right? Maybe it's a weight class that people aren't that excited about. Hey, let's throw it on as a Fight Night card, and a lot of people will gain more excitement, and there will be more traction gained around that division, and I think Grasso should Shevchenko 2 being brought out in this way is the perfect place to have this kind of a fight, because it might not be a fight that, all the MMA fans in the world are clamoring over because they have to see it happen again, but it's an oddly important fight for the division. It's not often you have an all-time great kind of, you know, in their swan song, if you will. So I think this is going to be a really important fight, and a fun one too, because Grasso did look greater last time out, proved a lot of people wrong, so it'll be interesting to see how well Shevchenko responds.
Three total UFC debuts at the bottom of the card, seven ranked fighters on this one, and a lot of sophomore showings, none bigger than a man returning exactly 6 years to the day since his UFC debut. That's Alex Reyes, second time out, taking on the short notice opponent being Charlie Campbell. So some big time fights in this card, only 11 total slated as we tape this on Sunday night. If anything changes, you know where to find us, here at Fight Night Picks on YouTube, so make sure you subscribe for all of those videos to come. Toss a like to get that traction rolling. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. And it's a UFC debut times two coming up this weekend. We have Dana White's Contender Series vets out of Sweden. It's Thunder, Josefine Knutsen. She's going to be taking on the sawed-off savage, Marnik Man. And for Marnik Man, I don't know if she's going for title of best or worst nickname, but when you look at Marnik Man and some of the performances that she's had, there's no denying that she's deserving of that nickname. She's willing to pull guard at all costs. She has great jiu-jitsu off her back. She's got a trippy body lock. I was going to say a tricky, but I went with trippy. She has a trippy body lock to trip takedown, and she's very aggressive when the fight does touch the mat. For Man, she wasn't able to get it done in her Contender Series fight last year. I picked against her on her Dana White's Contender Series show, and sure as shit, Bruna Brazil went out there. And listen, Marnik Man, I was down on her striking defense. That's why I picked Bruna Brazil. But Marnik Man with the hands down, Bruna Brazil with the foot up. She was able to land the shin on the face, and Man goes down. It's a
down call. Goes Man! Down goes Man! Like she's Joe Frazier.
That's it. It's a call heard around the world. So for Man, she takes some time off. She builds herself back up. Earlier on this year, she fights with the LFA against Amber Brown, a former Invicta Atomweight title challenger, somebody that have fought Hamasaki, Ashley Yoder. You had a lot of big names on Brown's record, but Brown was coming off of a 3.5-year layoff. Again, former atomweight moving up to strawweight. And in that matchup, Man, in the first round, struggled in the grappling. In the second round, she was able to rally back through it. The third round was very close, but Man was able to land some good ground and pound during the middle moments of that third round. She ends up picking up the decision win. So Man gets that win over 7-6 Amber Brown. unknown. And now after a while, she's in the UFC, and Mann's one of those interesting fighters because as big of a grappler as she is, we've seen her. If you go over to her Instagram, trust me when I say this, I spent 2 hours watching tape study on this fight today. I watched Marnik Mann fight in boxing contests this year, at least one of them on my journey through the YouTubes. Mann going out there boxing like she strikes in her MMA. Throws a little bit of a jab, throws the left hook, just goes to the well with that left hook like it's me playing UFC 4. Doesn't throw much of a leg kick. Again, struggles with some of the striking defense. And in this fight, Matt, for Marnik Mann, A, another fighter out of Montana. Very underrepresented state when it comes to big-time MMA. Yes, now all of a sudden you think of the bantamweight champ Sean O'Malley. But after that, who's out of Montana? The Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine? Who else do you have out of Montana? Not so many. So Marnik Mann representing Montana Mixed Martial Arts. Her life partner is also a fighter, so look out for that. 12-5 with no contest is Gage Saunders. But overall, again, Matt, for Marnik Mann, really is do or die with those takedowns. And well, if the fight doesn't touch the mat, she can struggle a little.
Do or die with a lot of her game is the real issue. When I went back and watched Mann, I just want to piggyback a little bit off of your striking defense note. It's not just as bad as she's stationary on the outside with her hands up. She can be known to freeze a little bit when she's moving backwards. And that's what does concern me. It's not a matter of, hey, my hands are up. If you hit my hands, that's good. If you go around them, good for you. She will just kind of get hesitant on the outside, especially backing up on that back foot. And that's how it did lead to that head kick loss that she suffered on Contender Series. That's the thing that I do worry about with Mann. You bring up her grappling. It is very strong when she's able to get it in positions that she can have success in. But Mann's somebody who will jump from submission to submission and not always secure the position after it. And that's something that does worry me in a matchup, really, against anybody in the strawweight division. Because a lot of these fighters we're seeing at 115 pounds. Remember, when Joanna was champ, it was a lot of specialists, right? Everybody in the top 15, they were just good at a different part of MMA. Whereas now, you have to be pretty well-rounded. And for Marnik Mann, I do like some of the things that she's able to employ in her game. But I don't like her striking moving backwards. And from the southpaw position, I think if she could weaponize her movement a little bit more, she'd have that much more success because she is kind of tricky with the way she holds her hands and her head. She does a good job of getting inside and outside of the pocket, but she doesn't make her opponent meet her halfway to accentuate her own punching power. And if that was a part of her game to where, hey, every single time you enter the distance, she's making you pay with a good shot, it would make her that much more difficult of an opponent to deal with, especially in a matchup like this.
So this fight is on short notice. You have to look at it. Josefine Knudsen fought back on August 22nd against Isis Verbeek over on Contender Series, and due to my travel schedule with work, you haven't seen a Contender Series show from us. So I follow along on Twitter on Tuesday nights, and by golly, by gosh, gosh darn it, were people upset that Josefine Knudsen didn't get a contract. So far, out of 25 fighters on Contender Series this summer, as of taping Sunday before another week of Contender Series, 22 have earned contracts, and Knudsen was not one of those fighters taking on Verbeek, and it was a story of these are two strikers. If you look at it for Knudsen, in 2018, she was a world champ in Muay Thai. She got a win there over Janet Todd, you know, former ONE Championship champ Janet Todd. So for Knudsen, I looked at her as being one of these fighters that from the outside, without watching any of the tape, okay, she's a striker, right? She trains at All Stars Training Center. You're only going to get better with your takedowns and your takedown defense. And then you go through it and you watch these Josefine Knudsen fights. And in her fight against Verbeek, the first strike that she throws after a bit of a feeling out process, a head kick, it rocks Verbeek. And then just like a pleasure man Anton Turcalli out of the same gym, she runs forward with a flying knee, and then she gets into a clinch position. And after watching all of these Knudsen fights, not just the fight against Isis Verbeek,
I thought she lost the Austin fight.
Dana White said, I just didn't see it tonight. He wanted to see more of the finishing instinct. When you go back and you watch these Knudsen fights, she gets into a lot of clinch positions. She tries to throw a lot of uppercuts, and they're very good. And she's incredibly strong when it comes to the wizard positions. Now, you hate to see that now.
After she can't get caught, though.
Yeah, after Jack Jenkins kind of popped that elbow against Chepe Mariscal last weekend. But going back through her fights, again, she beats Isis Verbeek against Jacinta Austin. I thought Austin won the first and the third round in that one as well.
She arguably could have won the second.
The fight that Knudsen had on Road to UFC against Yo Dam So, who was somebody that had fought Zhang Wei Li. So is coming off a three-year layoff, and yet Knudsen is a minus 1,300. She was able to defend the takedowns, use that wizard, get things into the clinch, and bust up her opponent in the striking. I think if you look at it for Knudsen, very, very intelligent guard.
Oh,
really
sure.
Good with her leg kicks. She keeps her hands really high. She doesn't tend to tire as these fights go on. Defensively, incredibly sound. And where striking's so good, Her clinch work, it sets up some of her knees, but not a lot of elbows. The uppercuts are good. Sometimes she can hang out in the clinch for a little bit too long, but she seems to be stronger than 90% of these women. And for Jacinta Austin, where that's a split decision win in her second to last fight, Austin, on the same day, is going to be fighting for the vacant Octagon Championship in this division. And if you don't know, now you know. Octagon is up for the World MMA Awards promotion of the year. So that's a big promotion. And Austin is a really good fighter. Won her next fight after losing a split decision to Knutson. So when I look at this fight, Matt, this is my handoff. I think Knutson wins this fight 9 times out of 10. And I don't think it's overly
competitive. When you say stuff like that, it makes me nervous.
Even though Knutson, again, she fought on August 22nd. It was announced on August 29th, a week later, that she'd be taking a fight on short notice against Yasmin Lucindo. Lucindo's out of the fight. So it was announced on September 8th that Marnik Mann would be stepping in. And both of these fighters now making their respective UFC debuts.
I agree with everything you said about Knutson. But there are a few things about her game that I don't really enjoy. Just from a way that it all works together in a big synergy. Because she does do a good job on the outside. But another area of her game, and I'm glad you bring it up, is the clinch. And she does do a good job offensively with the clinch. You will see those uppercuts, dirty boxing. You will see the elbows over the top. But she's just meeting her opponent halfway to shoot for some takedowns and make her life that much harder. And that's the one thing about her game that I don't know how it's going to translate up to the UFC level. Because if she is having success on the outside and decides to rush into her opponent and try to get some of those uppercuts off, you are just getting rid of your own space that's helping you get the win in the first place. So I do think she's the more talented striker on the outside. And I think that's primarily where this fight's going to be contested at. But if she does have that tendency to close her own distance off, it is going to make me worry when she's facing people at a higher level of competition.
Again, 27-5 in kickboxing, Muay Thai for Josephine Knutson, the former world champ there. For Marnik Mann, very adept once it touches the mat. And for Knutson, sometimes she can hang out off her back. She throws really good up kicks. You saw that in some of her fights. The fight against Verbeek, you saw a little bit of the grappling. You did see it against Austin. She will throw up the triangle, the armbar, so on and so forth to get herself out of position as well. So you look at this fight. It was thrown together on incredibly short notice. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 90% Knutson in this one.
I think it'll be under, but she'll be the favorite.
And wow. 424 total votes, 95% Knutson, 83% by decision. We live in a world where Sean Strickland is a middleweight champ, Matt. Anything is possible. Gosh,
this is a direct quote from me last night. If you told Sean Strickland the fight can go exactly how he wants it to go, I still don't think he'd win. So, hey, that's an L on my behalf.
I do think, though, that Thunder Knutson brings back the win to Sweden in this one.
I think she's going to get the win, but this is a fight that really interests me for both fighters moving forward and who they could fight next in their possible matchup. Because if Knutson does look good against Mann, is that definitely going to tell me everything I need to know when she's facing these other kind of prospects moving up the division? Not necessarily, so I would like to see her have a really nice performance, and then we can start talking about what's next, but I do have her in this
fight. Both of us going with Sweden's Josephine Knutson to get the win in the matchup. Let us know if you have the sawed-off Savage out of Montana in this one. Some big-time fights on the card. Matt, we're looking forward to Fernando Padilla taking on Kyle Nelson. That's a good one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. A short notice debut and a long awaited return. We have the former Dana White's Contender Series 2022 main eventer. It's the Cannibal, Charlie Campbell, in a battle of aggressive nicknames. He's going to be taking on the Executioner, Alex Reyes, a former UFC co-main eventer in a debut. Yes, that's right. For Alex Reyes, he's going to be making the return exactly 6 years to the day from when he replaced Thiago Alves on 3 days' notice to take on Mike Perry. That was UFC Fight Night Rockhold versus Branch in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yes, Chris Letang.
Where were you
in attendance for that one? Yes, Ian Cole was there as well with Ryan Reeves, Toronto Maple Leafs enforcer. But when you go back and you look at that fight, Matt, Reyes taking it on short notice, former lightweight, and what did they call him? Junior welterweight champ over with King of the Cage. Reyes taking that one on the short notice, fighting a human chicken that was Mike Perry in the build-up to the fight. Reyes with a little bit of nervous energy in the cage, but once they get down to business, it was a little bit of clinch work for Mike Perry. You think he's going to threaten with the elbows like he did against Hot Chocolate Danny Roberts. Instead, he pops that knee up there, and Reyes is out in the first round. So for Reyes, if you don't know the story after that fight, E. coli after a stem cell injection. Then he had spine issues. He's had a litany of injuries to get himself back into the cage. And he has had a little bit of a fallback plan. He does own Cage Combat Academy. His brother, you know him, former light heavyweight title challenger Dominic Reyes. The guys like Carlos Ullberg are calling out when Reyes is on a four-fight finish losing streak. But for Alex Reyes, what got him to the dance? Really good takedowns. Hyper aggressive in these lightweight fights. And when Alex Reyes gets you down to the mat, it's over. Like, you're toast. And he's one of those interesting guys, kind of similar to a Jack Della Maddalena that's on this card in terms of his record, where Alex Reyes loses his first two fights as a pro and then finishes 13 guys in a row like he's Lee Sand in the 90s, only to make it into the UFC to take on Mike Perry. So, Matt, for Alex Reyes, it was a Cinderella story cut short. The glass slipper's gone. I don't know how many more jokes I have left in the chamber. But, Matt, I know you were excited about Charlie Campbell coming on to Dana White's Contender Series. You were sold a bill of goods on this guy.
I still am. The guy is an absolute wild man.
And by the jeepers, he might not be credited with all the knockdowns, but I counted 4 knockdowns for Campbell against Chris Duncan, only for him to eat a straight right hand and get dropped in a 1-round barn burner against Duncan last year. Campbell comes back his last time out. He takes on a tricky fighter known as Josh Streaker, who was 9-5, and knocks him out. So for Campbell, Matt, I had a fun rewatch on his tape, let alone the tape on Alex Reyes, which is very aged at this point. It's like popping in a VCR. But I know you're down to clown when lightweights have knockout power like this.
I think this is a very exciting fight, and I think these are the type of opponents they should be fighting, right? Because who do you give a guy who's been in the UFC for 7 years to, but he's only had one fight, right? Like, the list is going to be fairly short for potential opponents, but Charlie Campbell's one of those fun prospects who, is he going to win every fight and become UFC lightweight champion? Probably not. But is he ever going to be in a boring fight? Like, we have Daniel Lacerda on this card, who has lost 4 fights in a row, more often than not by stoppage. But guess what?
No, they're all
I know, I'm just saying, most of his losses by stoppage. You know what the problem is, though? They've all been pretty exciting, so it's kind of hard to just say, like, hey kid, hit the road, we don't want to see you anymore. And I do think Charlie Campbell's going to become one of those types of fighters. Hopefully not gets his UFC career started off on 4 straight losses, but I do think he's going to be a fighter that, no matter what his record is in this organization, it's going to be somebody that you want to watch. But for Alex Reyes in this matchup, I'm going to have 2 really hard things that I'm going to be looking out for. A, if he's not able to secure that takedown and he is just forced to being on the back foot, kind of meeting Charlie Campbell's fire with his own fire when he goes for those forward flurries, I think he's going to have some trouble and face a little bit of adversity in those positions. But if he can make Charlie Campbell really work hard early, and I don't mean win takedown attempts and really secure them all, but just make Charlie Campbell burn those arms out, it might take a little bit of the pop out of his shots as this fight does continue, because I don't think Reyes is going to be in there to just eat shots for 15 straight minutes. I think he is going to try to put those wrestling shoes on earlier than later, but it's like what Chael Sonnen always says, like, you don't get better at something by not doing it, right? And with all this time off, and it's really concerning to see what version of Alex Reyes we are going to get in this, because you bring it up, quite a few injuries, the amount of time off itself, like, in 6 years, you might be a completely different person, completely different fighter. So for Reyes, I'm going to be really curious to see what types of improvements he's made.
I'll use 2 different examples to try and play it off. You look at a guy like Mike Malott, has a good fighting career.
Who I'm thinking of.
Mike Malott takes a really long time off, becomes coach Team Alpha Male, comes back into competition. Bob Gironcoli's in the UFC. The other guy that did it was a guy that beat Ike Valley Flag. And then took like 5 years off. That guy, Matt Wyman, lost 3 fights in a row in the comeback, punctuated by that Jordan Levitt slam loss to send him into retirement. So when you look at Alex Reyes, owns that gym, training with guys like Bobby Green down in Southern California, but also mixing it up in Vegas with some really good training partners. So look out for Alex Reyes in this one. Really big on the feet, really heavy shots, but also with the takedowns. When you look at Charlie Campbell, obviously, he's got power in his hands, really long extension on his shots, utilizes reach in the majority of his fights. He tends to be one of those power punchers out of Longo and Weidman MMA. But when I look at a guy like Charlie Campbell, I have one giant red flag that scares the bejesus out of me in every single fight. Is it the giant, like, slab that he has? Like a Dennis Schroeder bit of, like...
You mean the FIBA MVP Dennis Schroeder? Show some respect.
When I look at Charlie Campbell, when he's in the pocket and he's having success with his strikes, he tends to throw incredibly naked leg kicks, and his hands go from here to down below his waist, and he drops.
Like, I've got the comp.
He's got awesome leg kicks. You go back and watch his fight with Bellator against Nianoa Dung. He's a big underdog. That fight in Uncasville, Connecticut, that was headlined by Michael Chandler against Benson Henderson. But Campbell beats him by TKO due to the leg kicks. And Campbell utilizes leg kicks in every single one of his fights. to great effect. However, again, he drops his hands so far down, and you saw him throwing a kick, dropping his hands, and eating a right hand in tight from Chris Duncan, and that was his downfall in that fight. So going back and watching all the tape on Charlie Campbell, I thought his takedown defense was pretty good. You saw that against Chunky Boy, 163 for 155. Dos Santos, three fights ago. Chuck Campbell. Chuck Campbell goes over to
real close,
Chick Magnet Punk, and he's like, call me. Get me on the phone. And CM Punk has no idea what to do. It's like he's never touched a mobile device in his life. But when you look at this fight, Matt, again, it was originally supposed to be Natan Levy and Charlie Campbell with about a week's notice to take on Alex Reyes, who's been getting ready for multiple fights for years on end. So, Matt, we don't have any odds poster for this. This fight was just announced, but we do have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 80% on the younger fighters taking this on short notice.
I think it'll be over, mainly just due to the time off for Reyes.
All right, and it is a lot over. It's 388 total votes, 91% Campbell, 84% by knockout. And I have a hard time taking fighters coming off the layoffs. You mentioned one, another guy, charges Danho, the man mountain with about 4 years off, fights Jorgen De Castro, beats him by finish. But when there are these guys with these really long bouts of inactivity, I just struggle to take them, especially when you're a few weeks away from your 37th birthday. So for me, I'm going to go with Chuck Campbell, but the leg kick red flag is a giant one if I could throw one up there.
I agree with it 100%. The reasons that you bring up for Campbell potentially getting the loss in this, he does leave some openings when he is having his most success, and that is concerning, right? It's like, I like Dylan Brooks a lot more now because he played for Canada than I thought, but there's some players out there where they make their first shot, it's kind of the worst thing that could happen to them, right? Because it gives them that false sense of confidence. If Campbell does start moving downhill with a lot of his strikes, it can leave some of the counters, but I just don't know if Reyes, with all this time off, is going to be the guy to really make him pay for it. Once he does start to fight borderline ranked or even ranked lightweights, like guys like Jalen Turner are going to make you pay for things like that in your fighting style. I just don't know if Reyes, again, with all this time off, is going to be that guy.
All right, we'll see who's able to get it done. Will it be the Cannibal or the Executioner? Both of us going with Charlie Campbell out of Longo and Weidman MMA to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including Tracy Cortez against Jasmine Jazvisius up next. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
UFC Noche must kind of coincide with the blue moon, because coming up this weekend, we have a Tracy Cortez fight. They never happen. She's going to be taking on Canada's Jasmine Jazvisius. And if this fight goes anything like the FIBA basketball championships, Matt, maybe Canada will be able to beat the U.S. once more. And when you look at a fight like this, it's got to be a little bit awkward. I mean, for Jasmine Jazvisius, she gets to walk around backstage, and it's kind of like that Brian Windhorst meme. She gets to see Elise Reed.
Does she know what's going on with the Utah Jazz?
No, she gets to see Elise Reed in the backstage. They fought in a title fight over a CFFC, and it was Jazvisius losing, I'd say now, a controversial split decision against Reed in that matchup. But Jazvisius is able to carry it forward, also make it to the UFC, beat Kay Hansen in a debut, lose a fight to Natalia Silva. And since then, Jazvisius has definitely taken a level up with her striking in her last two matchups against Gabriela Fernandez, who was a turtle off her back in the takedowns. Jazvisius was able to kind of carry through with her natural martial art, which is the wrestling. Former Canadian silver medalist champ in the freestyle discipline. But when you look at it for Jazvisius, her last time out in Vancouver against Miranda Maverick, I and most people had her pegged to get the loss. And she was kind of having some trouble in the first round against Maverick. But by goodness, she was able to rally back round two, round three, and work in her striking and look very, very good. So she's looking to carry forward that momentum with Niagara Top Team into this fight against Fight Ready's own Tracy Cortez. And for Cortez, she was due a fight back last December against Amanda Hibas, and that fight was out due to some medical issues. So for Cortez, this is the first action since she was able to beat Melissa Gatto by decision. That was quite a while ago, exactly back in May of last year. I mean, even before that, a win over Justine Kish by split decision where Cortez missed weight by half a pound. She got dropped in the third round of that one really quickly. But Cortez has had some really close fights. She was known as a finisher outside of the UFC. She had that Invicta split decision win over Erin Blanchfield. I rewatched that fight today. I still think Blanchfield won the first round. The third round, Cortez gets a win over Maria Agapova on Contender Series, and then she's been off to the races. But we've primarily seen Cortez's wrestling in the UFC, whether it's been at 135 pounds or at 125. You think of the fight against Stephanie Edgar, where she's able to dominate in that discipline against somebody who's pretty darn accredited on the ground. But again, for Cortez, we almost want to see a finish. We almost expect a finish. And this is a battle between number 14 and Cortez, number 15 and Jazz Avizius, and a bit of a shark tank all of a sudden in the flyweight division. So I'm eager to get your take on this fight because both of these women, their styles kind of complement each other. And it could either be an awesome fight or kind of a stale fight. I don't know.
And that's exactly how I was going to start. Stylistically, these two mirror each other in a lot of different areas. And that's why I think it will result in a pretty fun fight. The thing about Tracy Cortez is, it does feel like you kind of know what the result of her fights are going to be after the first 2 or 3 minutes of the first round, right? Like, if she's able to secure the takedown, if she's not getting stuck in too many compromising positions on the mat, well, she's probably going to rinse and repeat for the second round. And if she does have anything left in the tank, she'll probably do the same in the third round. And that's the thing about Cortez. I think her cardio comes down to more her pacing and her ability to go out there and get the takedown, more than her having poor cardio by any means. I just think she spends a lot of energy trying to get those takedowns. And if you do a good job defensively, you can burn her out quite a bit and make her just a diminished version in that third round. And that's where this fight does get interesting, because I was really impressed by the pace that Jasmine was able to put on in her last performance. And not just the pace, just the consistency was nice to see out of her, because we had really only seen a lot of the grappling out of her before the last couple of matchups and before her last loss. So it has been nice to see her continually add new things into her game, even at 34 years old, because that's not often an age at flyweight that you see fighters make these wholesale adjustments to their MMA skill sets. But Jasmine has been able to incorporate a lot more of the striking into her game.
You got to talk about that gym a little bit too when you mention that with Niagara Top Team, because you see Matt DiMarcantonio in the corner, former fighter. He main evented a St. John, New Brunswick fight years ago. But also Anthony Romero, you've seen Mike Malott in the gym as well, and you've seen some other Ontario-based fighters kind of mix it up there. So credit where it's due with Niagara Top Team.
I just have a really hard time with this point in this fight. I think Jasmine probably has the more well-rounded game, I'd say, at this stage of her career. Tracy, like you had said, does go for a lot more of the wrestling, and it really does seem like, hey, if she's going to win a fight, it's going to be a lot with her wrestling and her top pressure, and if she's going to lose a fight, well, she's not going to be able to acquire any of those things. But I will never get this out of my head after we saw Carla Esparza fight Tatiana Suarez. You have two fighters who are both really good wrestlers, right? Both much better than their contemporaries are with the wrestling. Suarez might have been like only 5% better with her wrestling, and that fight didn't look close at all. So I do worry about this matchup being, hey, if Jasmine or Cortez even has that 5 or 10% advantage with their own wrestling, will that be enough to just use that one tool of their game and get the win using that?
So Cortez struggled in some of the submissions against Melissa Gatto.
Which is
she was able to win the first and the third round in that matchup, gets the win against Justine Kish. Judge score 30-27 Cortez. The next judge, 29-28 rounds one, rounds three, Cortez. The other judge, round two, round three, Kish. I think it was kind of crazy that judges weren't unanimous in giving Kish the third round, because she was able to, off the body kick, land a right hand that drops Tracy Cortez. And again, I didn't think that she won that fight against Blanchfield. However, when I look at Jazz Avizius in this matchup, historically, how have I picked Jazz Avizius fights? Good question, listener and watcher. I picked Kay Hansen to win. I picked Jasmine to win her second fight out. I picked Gabby Fernandez to win. I picked Miranda Maverick to win. I'm 0-4 in picking Jazz Avizius fights in the UFC. She's got 78% takedown defense so far in that small sample size. So we'll see how this one goes, because I think activity on the feet, Cortez continuing to train at fight ready, you're only going to get better in that discipline with Santino DeFranco and Eddie Cha there as well. But when you look at a fight like this, Matt, odds, they're pretty darn close. Tracy Cortez, a slight favorite, roughly a minus 130 in this one. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you. I think the lion's share going to be with Tracy Cortez. I'm going to say over under 82.5% Cortez.
I think it'll be under 82.5, but she'll be the favorite.
It is under. 831 total votes, 71% Cortez, 89% by decision. So you're going with Tracy Cortez in this one, I feel.
No, I am as split down the middle as you possibly can be. The reason I bring up that wrestling point is, though, if Cortez can just be heavy enough in the top position, I think she can win rounds that way. And again, I don't think it's going to be the most aesthetically pleasing way to go out there and win a round, but top pressure, guess what? That does a lot better than the person being on bottom defending against said top pressure. So I do think I am going to slightly side with Tracy Cortez, but it's a difficult fight because if she's not able to secure those takedowns, she hasn't shown us enough improvements in the other parts of her game, at least at this point for mean, to really be convinced that, hey, she can win a 15-minute fight just using the clinch, or a 15-minute fight just using her boxing. I think those things are starting to come along, but not enough yet, and that's why I have a hard time with this fight.
And for Cortez, it'll be interesting to see, I mean, with a brother that's a fighter, with all the story, you know, her story kind of coming into the UFC, a lot to digest, and I'm sure we'll hear quite a bit about that at UFC Noche. For me, give me Jasmine Jazz-Vizis. Maybe we'll go 0-5
yes!
picking her fight so far. We'll see how that one goes. I'm going with Canada's Jazz-Vizis. And I think, again, activity on the feet. We saw that against Maverick. We saw a good gas tank there as well.
For sure.
And we saw the takedowns play a bit of a factor. The only time we've really seen Jazz-Vizis struggle is round the outside killer Natalia Silva.
Silva was able to get her down a couple times.
And she was. Silva was able to get 2 takedowns in that matchup as well. Go 2-for-3 in the fight. But for me, I'm going Jazz-Vizis. We're split on the pick in this one. Let us know in the comments who you have. Let us know who you have in all of these fights, because Matt, the next one, it's going to be Edgar Shaidas taking on Daniel Lacerda. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Fiery flyweights in need of a couple of wins. Coming up this weekend, we have Mexico's own Pitbull, Edgar Shaidas. He's going to be taking on Miojo Daniel Lacerda. You might see it out there, Daniel De Silva, and your friends might tell you, hey, everybody from Shoot the Box, Diego Lima, they win these days.
No, your friends are telling you, Craig, he's lost 4 straight. Put it to rest. Why are we still talking about him?
Well, they're really talking about Shoot the Box like it's Danny Cage's Monster Factory. But all I know is where the comparisons stop at Shoot the Box is the fact that, yeah, he might dye his hair blonde. And yeah, he might have pictures on his Instagram with Charles Oliveira. But for Daniel Lacerda, he's had 4 fights in the UFC. I can break him down really easily.
How'd they go for him, Craig?
Finished in all 4 of them, but gosh darn it, they've been fun. And his last time out, he had CJ Vergara on skates in the first round of their matchup. I counted 4 knockdowns. The UFC officially counted 2. Lacerda had Vergara running the opposite way. And then in the second round, Vergara was able to get the fight down to the mat. There was a point where Lacerda had him in a bit of a calf slicer like he was Brett Johns. But then Vergara was able to spin out of the position, get on top, and Lacerda wasn't able to play jiu-jitsu for any longer. You saw a lot of big elbows, a lot of big shots from Vergara, and the fight was over. So it was one of those unique 2-round fight of the nights. But for Lacerda, it's been a wild run. He's able to drop Jeff Molina early in their fight, only for Molina to rally back. He's able to get the fight down to the mat against Francisco Figueiredo. And then that other Figueiredo took his leg home with him in a knee bar. He was also able to go there against Victor Altamirano, drop him early, springboards back up. And then Altamirano drops Lacerda, who had his hands way out and just ate that punishment that was coming down against Altamirano. So Lacerda gets this opportunity to right some wrongs in this fight. But as fun as he is, boy, he's fast and loose with his style.
This is what Daniel Lacerda reminds me of. You know those kids in like 4th, 5th, 6th grade who play sports and they're amazing? Like way too good at that age to be at that level. But then they start to get older and they just kind of rely on those exact same things that made them great when they were younger. But they didn't add the other components to their game. Daniel Lacerda reminds me a lot of those kids because he does. Can he finish fights in the feet? Yes. Can he finish fights in the mat? Yes. And if you just look at a snapshot of everything he does, you're probably thinking, wow, this guy's a very talented fighter. But once you look for all the gaps in between the main skill sets of MMA, the things that aren't just pure wrestling, the things that aren't pure kickboxing and jiu-jitsu, Daniel Lacerda does miss a lot of those components to his game. And that's why, even though he is on this 4-fight losing streak, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I have an easy time predicting his fights, because every single one of those fights has had a flash where, hey, he did look better than I probably thought he was going to. And I'm glad you bring up the last performance, because I had completely written him off that last time out. I'm like, oh, CJ Vergara is going to dust him. And then he still gives you a reason to believe in Daniel Lacerda. And that's why no matter who he fights, whether it's a box full of pool noodles at a Walmart or some entry-level UFC fighter, he could easily win a $50,000 bonus based off it.
Spinning wheel kick was the first knockdown. Straight left was the second. The third knockdown, another spinning wheel kick. And the next one was a flurry of punches. And I counted 4 knockdowns. Maybe the last one was a wobble against Vergara. But Lacerda is one of those guys where he's won all 4 of these fights in the first 30 seconds. And then after that, other things have happened to cause him to lose them by finish. And if you go back and watch Lacerda fight on the regional scene before he was in the UFC, it was a lot of kind of similar game.
When he gets tired, do you think he says like, oh, this never happens?
Oh boy, my conditioning. Yikes. But when you look at Lacerda, all the training partners in the world, you saw a very young It was weird when the promotion yesterday, and yesterday for us was UFC 293, they go, well, Lipe Daytona, he turns 23 tomorrow. So on the graphic, they show him as 23, but you're still 22 though. But Lipe Daytona comes in, has a fight of the night against a number 10 ranked Manel Kopp. We'll see if Lacerda can try and pick up some of that magic. When you look at a guy like Edgar Chaides, he's one of those really, really interesting fighters. The former Combate, you can see it right there. Flyweight champ, it's Edgar Chaides. And if you consider this matchup, Matt, for Chaides, it's an awesome opportunity to be able to fight on a card like this with a lot of your teammates. He's an Entram gym guy. Brandon Moreno spent a lot of time there. He's kind of all over the place for his camps. But you also have Yasmin Jauregui on this card. And if you go down through the performances, you already recognize him from Dana White's Contender Series. He did lose to Clayton Carpenter. But if you watch the first round of that fight, he gave Clayton Carpenter everything he could handle in that first round. Chaides won the first, and the rest of the fight was very competitive. But you watch a guy like Chaides when he's striking, he's all over the map. He can spin kick like the best of them inside of a phone booth. His hip flexibility is insane to throw.
Yeah.
Some of the kicks that he throws, but the spin back elbows as well. So Chaides definitely posed a tough test. For Edgar, I hope you appreciate this. He reminds me of a sparkler. It was recently Canada Day. You had an odd relationship with sparklers. I feel like you get burned by them every single
always
year.
Always grab the end of them.
But that's what I mean. So you would know better than anybody. Once you light a sparkler, can you get it to stop? Not really. And for Edgar Chaides, he does fight a little bit
in water.
Well, I guess you can put it in water, but he does fight a little bit like a sparkler. Once he gets going, it is very difficult to slow that momentum and slow that pace. Now, when we look at a guy like Edgar Chaides, his last time out, Fury FC 55, he's going out there and he's taking on a decent level of competition. But if you do the kind of the deep dive on the record, all 10 of the Chaides wins are by finish. The combined opponent record 56-29-1. But I mean, the last couple, it was a little bit chintzy.
So he's got a fifth round loss. He's got decision losses. Like when Edgar is forced to really elongate his game and forced to become that same fighter that he is in those first initial bursts, it is really difficult for him to elongate that success.
And I mean, with Fury, you had a pre-main event promo in cage from Brandon Moreno on Dana White's Contender Series. As they're making the walk, Chaides has Moreno in his corner. And there's also Brandon Moreno in a tiny screen-in-screen giving a breakdown of Edgar Chaides. So a lot of kind of support there from the champ. But my biggest part about this was, Matt, the fight that he had against Vasquez, where poor Frank Collazo, and I'll put it up there, that was the most disgusting non-finished call I've ever seen in my life. And Chaides was struggling in that fight quite a bit. Like, you could have had a few of the rounds very close, but in that, once they got to the title rounds or the championship rounds, it was a triangle choke that was synced in where the guy, Vasquez, is completely out. The referee doesn't see it. The commentators are yelling, stop the fight, stop the fight. And then he goes for an armbar, dislocates his opponent's elbow. And then finally, Vasquez wakes himself up and taps out of it. It was wild to see that. Again, you can go back and watch some of the Combate fights, the UWC fights for Chaides. The tape is readily available. And Chaides, in that debut against Tatsuro Taeda, second round, third round, struggle with the grappling. First round, I don't normally go by the numbers. However, he was 27 of 30 on his significant strikes. That's a massive percentage. He was able to really land a nice leg kick that kind of dropped for a quick second Taeda. And then when Taeda came in close in the phone booth, as I said about Chaides, it was a short left hand. That dropped Tatsuro Taeda in that first round. So for Chaides, he was able to go out there and show a little bit in that matchup. But again, that fight that he took was on a week and a half's notice at a catchweight of 130 pounds against one of the hottest prospects in this division. Chaides is one of those fighters, we've likened him to a little bit of a Chepe Mariscal, where Chaides fought good fighters before coming into the UFC. He didn't win all of those fights. You don't get to 10-5 by doing everything the right way. But for Chaides, another good opportunity to kind of get back on the horse in this fight.
And he does have great grappling in his own right. I know we didn't get to see that the last time out against Taeda, but guess what? Tatsuro is really, really, really good at this stage of his career, and that is the one X factor that he brings into this division. So I do expect Chaides to have a lot more success with his own grappling, especially in this matchup, because if Lacerda does just try to march forward, not even march forward, just blitz forward wildly, it's going to leave those openings for him to not only get caught by by counters on the feet, but also for Chairez to go underneath, get the hips, and go for the takedown, because if he's able to get that top position on Lacerda, I know Lacerda can be squirrely off the back. I don't know if it's going to be enough, though, to actually put Edgar in compromising positions to where he won't be convinced that, hey, I just keep on getting these takedowns over and over again, because he's got a great submission repertoire in his own back pocket.
I think this fight's going to go this way. These two guys are going to go rock'em, sock'em, robots, and one of the two is going to drop. I have a really hard time offering you a prediction in this fight because Edgar Chaeta is more than a 2-1 favorite in this matchup, and not all four fight finish losing streaks are created equal. This isn't BJ Penn taking on Yair Rodriguez. We have a look at the votes over on Topology, Matt. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Chaeta's.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is over. 783 total votes, 89% Chaeta's, 60% by knockout for the 11% that have Lacerda, 62% by knockout. So again, I think it's whoever drops first is going to be the one that might lose it, even though we could have a multiple knockdown type situation. Maybe it's like a Dan Hardy, Carlos Condit, two hooks land, and whoever gets up, gets up. But yeah, like I said, I have a hard time trying to offer you a pick in this fight.
You know what I'm never going to do, though? Pick a guy who's lost four straight fights by stoppage. Guess it's just a rule I have, yeah. You know? If you've been stopped in four straight fights, I'm probably not going to pick you to get off the horse in your next one. So Lacerda, again, I can't say it enough times. He's going to make this fight exciting, win, lose, or draw. I just don't see it being a win or a draw, so that's why I have Edgar in the matchup.
We'll see if a mass bulk order of blonde hair dye is able to pull out the victory this time, or if Daniel Lacerda is the second coming of one of his teammates that everybody forgets, Thomas Almeida. It was bright until it wasn't, Matt. Both of us, I'm also going with Edgar Chaeta's in the matchup. It's hard to pick a guy on a four-fight losing streak to win, but he's got a shot in this one, so let us know who you have down below in the comments section. Some big-time fights on the card. Main event's a title fight on a fight night at T-Mobile. They're stacking the deck. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Out is Chris Curtis, so Fluffy Hernandez is to fight Roman Kopylov on short notice. Out is Fluffy Hernandez, so in on short notice is Josh Fremd, a guy who won a fight a few weeks ago weighing 189 pounds. And out of that, he was looking for a new contract. Well, gosh darn it, he got it. So Matt, Josh Fremd, represented by Jason House, a manager who's known to corner his fighters, which is a little bit unorthodox. But for Fremd, his last time out, he got the win over Jamie Pickett. And he's riding somewhat of a win streak coming into this matchup. Fremd's one of those guys where you knew that in the bright moments, sometimes he didn't shine himself the brightest. You saw that against Gregory Rodriguez in the middleweight main event. It was the finale of a little bit of a tournament, four-man tournament that they had for the belt. Fremd got finished in that matchup, but he moved it forward. He fought on a Dana White's looking for a fight card, and then he ended up in the UFC. Lost in a matchup to Anthony Fluffy Hernandez. Then he was on the losing end against Trayshawn Gore. In it was like if you had a friend that liked to take daisies and go and pop the head. Like, you saw a Gore submission that was absolutely grotesque. So, for Fremd, his last two times out, he's definitely proven some people wrong. Gets the win over SD Dumas as an underdog. Utilize that Slippery Rock Wrestling University wrestling that he has in his back pocket. And then his last time out did about the same against Pickett. And this is the part that I have to accentuate in a fight like this against these two guys, Matt. Roman Kopylov was in the same position not that long ago. And both of these fighters are a reason that you morons that fill up comment sections and Twitter comments have to just take a step back. And this is my point. When people go, why do you guys talk about fights that happened years ago? This fight is precisely why you go back and you watch what got these guys to the dance. Because for Roman Kopylov, he was a fresh-faced newcomer with AMC Fight Nights Global. He became their middleweight champ on a 7-fight finish streak, comes into the UFC, and loses by submission to Carl Robertson. Takes a lot of time off and loses to Albert Duraev. And everybody casts these guys off when they lose two fights to start the UFC career as chopped liver. Well, sure enough, Roman Kopylov in his last three fights has finished his last three opponents, and all you had to do was watch how impressive he was in the regional scene to be able to tell people that, geez, this guy's a pretty good fighter and not just a guy on a two-fight losing streak, not just some rando. So
I guess, but I gotta also say, I've never seen a guy start his UFC career off on two losses and immediately thought to myself, oh, he's gonna fight for the title soon. Like, I think both parties do have a little bit of merit to them. I agree with you. You do have to go back and look at the body of work somebody had, but I've never, and I watched a lot of UFC. in MMA. I've never seen a person get their career off to an 0-2 start and immediately thought, wow, they're destined for big
things. No, but when you're trying to talk about the fights, you can't just go, well, this guy lost.
You can't call people morons, though, for not believing in people who start their career 0-2.
You just look at people that, they're the type of people that talk to their friends and they go, geez, did you hear about that? And then you question them on it and they're like, oh no, I just read the headline. They're headline news readers. They're mouth breathers, and at the same time...
And I agree with their big point, it turns out.
They don't see the forest through the trees. So when it comes to a fight like this, when you look at Josh Fremd, when you look at Roman Kopylov, they do it in different ways. Fremd is one of those guys that's going to strike to wrestle, and then once he gets down and the fight to the mat, he can be a little bit tricky. And for Kopylov, tricky southpaw sidewinder, performance bonuses last time out against Claudio Ribeiro, an awesome, awesome accuracy to his shots in the first round of that one. He did get stung by that big, what was it, a left hand that Ribeiro was able to throw. If it wasn't, it was a straight right, but regardless, at the very end of the first round in that one, only to follow it up with an undefended head kick to knock his block off. So when you look at this one, Matt, two guys at different points in their career, it does feel like a big step up for Fremd on the shorter notice in this matchup. Though in total, Kopylov had a month to get ready for a fight in Vegas, and Fremd had, what, like a week, 2 weeks?
It is a big step up for Fremd, especially his level of competition, but I do think he has all the skills to go out there and win this fight, especially if he can figure out what Kopylov is doing at range. But there's one big thing about Josh Fremd that even in his last fight that he won, he does, and I don't like it. When he's uncomfortable on the outside on the feet, he will have that tendency to just rush for the clinch, and if he's doing that against a guy like Kopylov, not shooting it for takedowns, it's very different. Closing the distance for a body-to-body overhook, underhook is more just you getting your head out of danger and then trying to chain wrestle from that position, which are things he can do, don't get me wrong. It's just, if he's doing that against Roman Kopylov, more cognizant of, hey, I gotta get myself out of danger instead of, hey, I gotta take him down so he's less of a threat. I think that's a big difference in mindset and execution too, because if Fremd is just trying to clinch up to avoid some of those bigger shots on the outside, Kopylov still does have deceiving power in weird angles too. He can get uppercuts even when you're chest to chest, he'll hit you with weird shots, and I think those are the types of shots that could hurt Fremd and get his attention. But if Fremd can use some of those entrances to take down Kopylov, it's going to be a completely different fight because Kopylov will load up a lot on his shots. I do like the accuracy, don't get me wrong. Even on his hooks and his overhands, he does do a pretty good job of, once he throws them, he does land on his point. But he can get caught loading up a lot of those bigger power shots. And if he does find himself not just throwing the techniques for the techniques, if he is trying to knock out Josh Fremd and not letting the knockout come to him, it can be a really difficult night for Kopylov, because for as good of a striker as he is once he's moving forward, fighting the fight on his terms, when he's moving backwards, not that he's a bad fighter by any means, he's still a very dangerous one at that, but it eliminates a lot of the tools from his own toolbox. You bring up the head kick. Kicks are something he does a lot better when he has his opponent behind the black lines than when he is behind the black lines. And when he's able to start incorporating the kicks along with his boxing, he becomes a much more difficult fighter to deal with.
And my mistake, Kopylov got his performance bonus against Puna Soriano as an underdog in that win. But the last three fights, he retires Manzo. Alessio Di Chirico beats Puna Soriano, and then very, very recently was able to get the win over Claudio Ribeiro. For Josh Fremd, you've seen him succeed against long-range strikers like Joel Bauman on the regional scene. But when you do look at this, I did listen to an interview, My MMA News, John Eric Poli, one of the best stressed interviewers out there, always in suit and tie. And Poli asked him about the new deal. It's a new four-fight deal for Josh Fremd. He said he took 4 or 5 days, more or less, to reset, get back in the gym, try not to blow up in terms of the weight, which is obviously underlined by a little bit of a funny thing, being 189 your last time out. And he said, the weight cut made my arms feel like 1,000,000 pounds. That was a quotable from his last time out, because he was at 189. So Matt, back-to-back southpaw camps for Fremd, as he said in his own words in that interview. So he's looking forward to another one in this matchup. Kopylov is a big favorite at about a 3-1. We have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise us there to you. Topology voters been wild lately. I'm going to say over under 85% Kopylov.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's, oh my, 776 total votes, 96% Kopylov, 84% by knockout. For the 4% that are Fremd, 27% by knockout and 43% by decision. Matt, I'd like to hear from the fans as to who they have in this one and why. For me, I have Roman Kopylov. I think that tricky southpaw striking is going to lend credence when it does, whether it's at distance or in the pocket. I think he has such an advantage with the striking and the power. We even saw it in the fight against Albert Duraev. He's able to bust up that eye that always gets busted up. So for Kapilov, though, he did struggle in the takedowns, but Duraev is very good. He's like a dog on a bone with those takedowns. That got him to the ACA, ACB, welterweight, middleweight championship. So for me, I do have Kapilov in this one. Trains a lot with Armin Petrosian at Universal Fighters and Ratty Team. You've seen Kapilov out of that gym as well, with Razul Magomedaliev as his coach. So for me, Kapilov trains with a lot of wrestlers and a very, very good striker in this division. So I do have him in the fight.
I've also got Kapilov, but again, if he does find himself waiting behind those two black lines, trying to set up that one big power shot and not really reacting as well to, hey, I'm striking, now I'm digging for underhooks, trying to defend takedowns, I think he is going to be able to win this fight largely based on the striking advantage I perceive that he has. But again, if Frem can get him backed up, get him up against the cage, and force him to try and decipher what's a strike and what's a takedown, I think he can go out there and get the win. But I do have Kapilov.
Both of us going with Roman Kapilov to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including the title fight in the main event. And hey, a co-main event. It's Kevin Holland taking on Jack Della Maddalena. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. UFC Noche, and on the card at strawweight, Lupe Godinez was due a rematch with Sam Hughes. Elise Reed was due Cynthia Calvillo. Calvillo's out. Hughes is out. Godinez gets Reed, and we get a fight, Matt. When you look at this matchup for Lupe Godinez, two wins in a row. She beat Cynthia Calvillo, and her last time out looked pretty darn good against Emily Ducati. And if you look at it for Elise Reed, gets the win even with the takedowns of Jinyu Fry. And that's one of those things. For Elise Reed, a Taekwondo black belt to the nth degree. She's been a gym owner since the age of 25. You hear that all the time. At a Kickside Martial Arts in New Jersey. But when you look at it for Reed, I mean, strikes on the outside, the kicks on the outside, those really are her hallmarks. And you saw it even in her fight as an underdog against Melissa Martinez. Martinez really good with the boxing. Martinez is crashing the distance. Martinez goes for a body kick, and off that, Reed throws a punch and drops Martinez in the first round. So for Reed, a really interesting case, because we probably haven't seen the best of her in the UFC. She does have a record of 7-3, but interesting for her on this 3-3 run is the fact that she's been an underdog in even some of these wins. I mean, Corey McKenna and that aforementioned Melissa Martinez fight. So for Reed, I mean, the mat is lava in just about every fight, because if you're getting submitted by Muay Thai striker Loma Lookbunmi, then Lord only knows what could happen. And for Lupita Godinez, boxing really the hallmark. I always talk about that Lindsay Garbat BTC title fight, but for Godinez, she can go out there, she can put the wrestling shoes on in her own right. She was one of those fighters that tried to do the unthinkable, fight on a week between fights. She gets the win down at strawweight. She moves up against Luana Carolina, wins the first round of that one, and then gets outstruck on the outside and tended to fade as that one went on. But Godinez really able to prove those naysayers wrong in those last two wins. Beats Ducati, who's a great outside striker, loves to throw the kicks both to all three levels, and along with her boxing. So when you look at this fight, I think one of the big storylines that people are going to throw away on this one, but they will mention in the main event, Lupita Godinez for this fight, not training at Titan MMA in Vancouver. She's training down at Lobo Gym in Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico. Matt, the elevation there is 1,566 meters. The elevation in New Jersey, whether it's at either Kickside location, Princeton or Hillsborough, less than 100 meters. Lupita Godinez at elevation. Elise Reed at sea level. I don't know what Cain Velasquez.
Sam Alvey slept in an oxygen tent, altitude tent every night, and it didn't help him. So.
Altitude tents and actual elevation aren't the same thing.
Just saying. Well, not everybody who fights in Mexico or Denver is undefeated. It's a nice thing to have in your back pocket, but I don't think it makes all the difference
trust
in the
me.
World. The
trust
flip
me.
Side is, though,
trust
you
me.
Get less out of your workout
trust
because the
me.
Air is thinner.
Kyle Nelson beat Marco Polo Reyes in Mexico City, and that's the next fight I'm going to talk about. But I think that's just a little bit of an added X factor for somebody who likes to wrestle a little bit in along with their boxing.
It is. The only question I have in this fight is, can Lupita Godinez get Elise Reed down to the mat? And can she do it for about more than 7 minutes? Because if she can do it for more than that amount of time, I think she can win decision in this
I think
matchup.
She can beat her with her boxing regardless.
I think that's a much more difficult way of winning. If you're fighting somebody who is a primary striker and you're also a grappler and you're well-rounded, do you think your coach is telling you, hey, strike with them? No, they're saying, hey, do the thing they're really bad at, which would be defensive grappling and grappling in general. So I don't think Godinez can win this fight if it's only on the feet. If it's just 15 minutes, minutes, I would pick Elise Reed in this matchup. If it was just 15 minutes of striking. But I think Godinez is able to not only mix in the takedown, but mix in the clinch to eliminate some of the rhythm that Elise Reed can get into when she is able to mix in her combinations of kicking range, then yes, Elise Reed might have a chance to win this if she is able to just keep Godinez off her for the majority of the fight. But I think Godinez does a good enough job with not only her takedown attempts, the clinch as well, to just get time and get moments off in those positions to win this fight based on decision. Because I think both fighters are going to have a really hard time getting a stoppage win in this matchup. Either Godinez with a submission or a TKO, or Elise Reed hitting her with a big shot on the feet and completely changing the complexion of this fight. I also said Sean Strickland probably wouldn't drop Israel Adesanya. So hey, what do I know? I just think that if you're looping into Godinez, you have all the tools to win this fight. And not an easy way, but a much easier way. So why would you go out there and just try to strike for 15
minutes?
And for
Elise Reed, they've continued to throw her wrestlers. I don't know if they want Elise Reed to be out of the UFC. But if you look at it, I mean, Corey McKenna, that's a win over on. Corey McKenna's close to home soil. And Reed was kind of on the losing end in a short notice fight up a weight class against Jerry Eubanks to take the UFC
kind
debut.
Again.
But since then, I mean, 50% takedown defense in the UFC, it's not the greatest thing in the world, but it is the number that is on the page. Matt, if you do look at it, numbers on a page for Godinez, her last time out, 119.5 was the weight, but she didn't miss the weight. It was a catch weight at 120 pounds. So we look at this matchup. Godinez is a big, big favorite. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over, under 85% Godinez.
I'll say over.
They are wild. Oh my gosh. 693 total votes, 97% Godinez, 82% by decision. There are 3% of fans that have Elise Reed to win this fight, including contrarians and people that like to be different. Matt, I do have Lupi Godinez in the matchup. It's MMA. Anything can happen. We know this. But for me, I do think Godinez, again, switching it up, working at working not just at Titan in BC. You know, a lot of those fighters out of BC that train in the similar areas, like Sarah Kaufman, like Jamie Lynn Horth, who's in the UFC now.
A 43-year-old bantamweight might not be the
best. Doesn't matter. All these women that train together. And utilize wrestling and good striking, but also for Godinez to go down to Mexico, work it with Alexa Grasso, Irina Aldana, Alessandro Costa with jiu-jitsu, and that John and Kate plus 8 hairdo that is Diego Lopez to work in a little bit of that ground game too. For those reasons, I have Lupita Godinez in the matchup.
I've also got Godinez, but if you guys ever hear me say he's been training with Andre Arlovsky down in American Top Team, pick against whoever I'm about to pick. I do have Godinez, though, because I think she is so much more well-rounded in the matchup.
I don't know. Last night at UFC 293, we did hear and he has Marcelo Gomes in his corner. Just something you don't hear every day. But Matt, both of us going with the Mexican-Canadian in the matchup. Lupe Godinez to get the win. Some big-time fights in this card. I can't wait for the co-main event at welterweight. Kevin Holland taking on Jack Della Maddalena. Check that video out. Toss a like on your way out. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And it's a second look in the UFC for Team Oyama. Sub 2-minute knockout winner. We're talking about El Valiente, Fernando Padilla. Was War Tyone the War Master that night? No, Josh Barnett would probably say no. But Padilla was able to get that win. He dropped Julian Arosa twice, and Tyone said, I don't need to see anymore. Padilla looking to turn the clock forward to take on the fellow Canadian, Muskoka Cottage Country's own, the monster, Kyle Nelson. And when you look at Kyle Nelson, he's one of those guys that just got a bad draw out of the gate. Early on, he takes on Carlos Diego Fajeda, up a weight class, had some success early in the fight, ultimately got finished in that one. But for Kyle Nelson, he might be 2-4-1 in the UFC. But I think the big snapshot for him is his last three fights. And it's a win, a loss, and a draw. And even in the loss, he loses against Jai Herbert, but he's able to land 15 thudding leg kicks that made a difference in that fight, especially as it went on. The draw, he's taken on Duho Choi, had success in the wrestling. Even though he had 5 takedowns, he was losing that fight on the feet. Duho Choi decides in the third round, I'm going to just nudge that head in a little bit closer to your head. He loses a point due to a headbutt in the third round, so it ends up as a draw. Nelson's last time out, he's a big underdog in Vancouver on that pay-per-view card, headlined by Nunes taking on Aldana. And in that one, Matt, Kyle Nelson on the winning end against Blake Builder. And Builder was having some success early on the outside. Kyle Nelson, he's got kind of a creaky stance to him. He just marches guys down. He's a little square. He throws
You're moving your head way too much to be Kyle Nelson.
Just everything moves. He throws that leg kick quite a bit, and it was weird because where he was able to touch up Blake Builder at the end of the first round. I thought it was a really close round until Nelson landed a big right hand that kind of got Builder's attention. And after that, round two, round three, Builder wasn't willing to crash the distance, and then Kyle Nelson was able to have all the success on the outside. And that might not happen in a fight like this, where Nelson's fighting at a disadvantage in terms of the reach by 5 inches by the numbers and 2 inches in terms of the height. But when you look at a guy like Fernando Padilla, there's a lot to like about this guy in this fight. El Valiente, the brave, Mexico's own Fernando Padilla, the former Fury FC champ. He got a win on Fury FC 46, looking for a fight. He was signed to the UFC, and that was back in 2021. You look at a guy like Fernando Padilla, he hasn't fought in a meaningful amount of time. He did an interview, and that's coming up with a guy that you guys know and love from MMA Sucka, James Lynch. And in that one, the question was, well, why is there such a layoff? And the quotable was, just the visa, really. To be real with you, just the visa issues. And other than that, he's been training for the last couple of years. And Padilla comes out of a great gym. We're talking about Team Oyama with some of the best in the world. Former champ Carlos Sparza, Colin Oyama. We've seen him corner a lot of fighters in the UFC. But for Padilla, you look at all of the fights. He starts off his pro career back at 18 years old in Mexico in a co-main event slot, of all things. And that was a card that was headlined, and one half of it was Jorge Gonzalez, you know, the guy that was supposed to be in the UFC, but he had a dirty USADA sussy. And Gonzalez just couldn't make the walk a few years ago. So when you look at it for a guy like Padilla, at such a young age, he was able to accrue a nice record. He fought a good level competition. He had a loss back to Dan Ige that was two fights before Ige was in the UFC. He had a win over Derek Minner where Minner was beating him and he took him down. And then all of a sudden, Padilla just pulls out a submission win and Minner's just like laid out on the canvas. It was just a crazy win over with the LFA. Padilla continues. He gets rolling. His last loss was to Spike Carlisle 4 years ago. He beats Nate Richardson by split decision. I went back and watched that. I thought that Padilla won that one. And then his last time out against Cameron Graves, it was like, listen, Padilla might struggle in this area, in that area. Padilla was walking him down, beating him silent. And Padilla, with all of those successes on the regional scene and whatnot, he's a tricky guy because he doesn't check leg kicks at all. Like, at all. And he stands heavy on his lead leg. I don't know what it could look like in a switch stance situation. And the other thing for Padilla, he does like to snap that jab out there, sometimes with not much behind it. I mean, you will see the right hand. You'll see it as a hook, an uppercut, so on and so forth. Not a big guy to be throwing feints out there, but the leg kick situation does kind of concern me a little bit in this fight.
It concerns me a little bit, but the thing about Kyle Nelson is he well-rounded? He is. He can win fights on the feet. He does do a better job on the outside than I think a lot of people would believe, at least offensively, and I think that comes down to he's normally eating shots from that position too in a lot of his matchups, so they will look a little bit more 50-50-ish or even a little bit less so for him if he is eating a lot of those shots, but he can have success in that one position. The thing that I do like about Kyle Nelson, though, is he's not going to beat himself. He's just going to try so hard that it might put him in positions where he could get beat, and I know that might sound like I'm trying to poke fun at him, but I'm not at all. He's going to pressure you forward. He's going to make it an ugly fight until he can't anymore, be it because he's eaten so many shots. And I do like that kind of a style against somebody like Padilla, who I had a lot of question marks coming into the UFC, especially based on who they gave him in his opening fight. Juicy. He's a good fighter, Julian Arosa. I know he's been stopped early in some matchups, but he's one of those fighters that, hey, if you catch him cold, you can probably knock him out and look really good. But if you can't catch him cold, he can ease his way into the fight. It's a really long 15-minute night for you out there. And for Padilla, I was really impressed to see him go out there and get the stoppage so quickly. But that's why I kind of have to get ahead of myself right now. Is it one of those performances where I try not to hype it up in my mind so much because it is against a well-known fighter who we all know can look really good on his best day? But Arosa's another one of these guys. I brought this up with Jamie Mullerkey last weekend. It's, hey, Mullerkey can look really good in some fights, but when you catch him early, it looks that much worse. For Padilla, I just want to say I don't want to put too much stock into the last one, even though it was a great win and whatnot. I just had a lot of those question marks, like you say, not only with the light kicks. When you can eliminate some of the range that he works with, you can have success against him. He holds those hands very high and almost like a borderline tie stance. It leaves the body open. It does leave the legs open. And if Kyle Nelson does have the game plan of, hey, I'm putting my head in his chest, I'm just going to make it an ugly fight, try to incorporate my own boxing, I think he can have a lot of success. I just worry about how many shots Nelson's going to eat on his way in to close that distance.
And against Billy Quarantillo, Kyle Nelson was on the receiving end of takedowns against, and it cost him. He went out there in the Jai Herbert fight. He struggled at range against the boxer. That could play out in this fight as well. But when you look at it for Fernando Padilla, when he needs to go in for the kill, he goes in for it. And you saw that against Arosa. 1-2-3. Then it ended up as a 9-punch combo. Drops Arosa twice. Tyone says no more. They protested the stoppage a little bit on commentary, and then they seemed by the end of it like they were cool with it. But Matt, when you do look at this one, we'll see if Nelson's going to go out there and employ the takedowns. We did see it against Choi. We also saw it against Matt Sales. But for Nelson, in 6 of 7 UFC contests, he was the underdog. The only time Nelson has been favored in the UFC was at Elevation, fighting against Mexico's own Polo Reyes, and he stunned the crowd, getting an early knockout win against a guy who's been knocked out a time or two.
So I was like 9-8 at the time.
When you look at this fight, Matt, Padilla is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Again, they're wild this week. So I'm going to say over under 90% Padilla.
I'll say under.
I'll say under. And it is slightly over. 783 total votes, 91% Padilla. 25% by decision, 66% by knockout for the 9% that have Nelson, 75% by decision. Why was Kyle Nelson able to beat Blake Builder, who's a good boxer but gets clipped, gets rocked in his fights, who has good stick-to-itiveness and good wrestling, because he was able to show that against Shane Young. Ooh, Shane Young. Matt, it was because Kyle Nelson threw a lot of body kicks and a lot of leg kicks. And again, I can't highlight that enough. He could try and do that against Padilla here, and he could have a lot of success with it, too.
If he stays at that range, I don't think he's going to have a lot of success with it. I think that's where what's going to lead to his downfall. If he does try to play that outside game, it just brings me to what I said the last video. Why would you do the thing that gives your opponent the best chance to give him a win? If you stay at range against Padilla, he does have much more punching power. He's got better variety to his shots, too, because Nelson is much more traditional with a lot of his boxing offense. He's not really going to wow you with the crazy things he does on the feet, whereas Padilla's going to make you pay with unorthodox shots. They're going to come in at weird angles. He's got that weird shovel hook, too, that almost comes in at like a three-quarter angle. I think those are all weapons he can use against Kyle Nelson to halt some of that forward pressure Nelson brings into the cage.
I'll go with Padilla in this one. It's UFC Noche. Kind of feels like he should probably win. I know that's kind of a lame way to go about it. But when you do look at Fernando Padilla, I think we brought up some good points for him as well as for Kyle Nelson in this one. So please let us know in the chat who you have in the matchup. Toss a like on your way out. We got some big time fights in this card. Holland versus Della, and in the main event, Grasso Shevchenko, a number two. You're not going to want to miss any of the action. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Vegas Beast, Mexican Dynamo, the Golden Boy. Daniel Zellhuber gets a big step up in competition. Coming up this weekend, he's taking on two-time UFC fighter. Yes, that's right. It's the Spartan Christos Yagos, a guy who's fought a Shark Tank of opponents, if you really consider
it. Do you have a Christos Yagos moment that stands out in your head? Because oddly enough, I do have one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you know who Charles Oliveira set the record for most submissions in the UFC against? He did it against Yagos, who just made his return the second time around in the UFC. And that's something that a lot of people might not make a big deal about, but that's a pretty good name to have as a submission win on your record.
Yeah, Christos Yagos, well, yeah, or loss, well, I guess. But Oliveira. For Christos Yagos, kind of like from My Morning Jacket's The Waterfall 2. Yeah, I got that one on vinyl. Like the song, still climbing the ladder, still paying my dues. Christos Yagos, representing Killcliff FC, is going to be one of those guys. I mean, he was able to get a win over Sean Soriano and then uproot his life from California to train with Sean Soriano at Killcliff in Florida. And since that time, well, Yagos went on to lose a few fights. He lost to Armin Tsarukyan and Thiago Moises. And in the Moises fight, he kind of cracks, it looks like. Moises got a little bit of a cut to the side of his head. Moises kind of grapples to the point where he gets the back, he gets the choke in, and it's like a no-hook neck crank. I went back and watched it today. Yagos taps, that's the end of the fight. But Yagos, last time out there, he's taking on Ricky Glenn, and by gosh, he cold-cocked him, and he hits him, and then Glenn springboards, and it's a knockout. So a performance bonus for Christos Yagos, a guy who has a couple of performance bonuses to his ledger. And the big knock against Yagos, and kind of the weird thing about him, especially in that last 4-fight sample size. I know we use 5-on-in to decry the last 5 fights, but or decry, whatever you want. Maybe we showed it from the rooftops. Maybe my neighborhood's weird that way. But when you look at Christos Yagos, just the 4-fight sample size being the one that I'm talking about, they've all ended before the end of the second round. And that's been a little bit of kind of a pin. If you want to pop the balloon of Yagos, it's, well, when it goes over 3 rounds, you look at his fight, even against Carlton Minus, he starts to get tired in that 3rd round. But for Yagos, a workhorse, he's good at all the things.
He is.
But defensively, he can struggle in some of the things.
This is the thing that this is the problem I've always had with the skill set of Yagos. Because you're right. Is there a single thing he does in the octagon that you really have a problem with? Just when you talk about his skill set. Not really. Like, oh, he's been submitted by Thiago Moises and Charles Oliveira. That doesn't mean you're a bad grappler by any means. And Yagos, to his credit, is a very talented grappler. But the thing about Yagos, though, that I hate is He's not like a guy who gets tired and still fights like the same fighter. He starts to fight dumb when he's tired, and he won't necessarily do the same things he does when he is 100% energized. Those hands get pretty darn low when he's tired, and he still will walk into a lot of volume. And those have been things that do tend to lose him those third rounds, and that's been my big concern about Yagos. I know he can win the first round. I know he can win the second round. And guess what? He can put on a surprisingly high pace for a guy who does have those cardio issues in the third round. And that's why I do think Yagos, more than anything, has a pacing problem. If he could just figure out a way to extend, give 20% of your volume in the first and second round, and just save those for the third round. Because guess what? You're still probably doing more than enough to get the win in the first and second round if he's not getting clipped by a major shot or taken down for a lot of time. Because Yagos, for being as well-rounded as he is, he can struggle against opponents who are specialists of that one area, and we have seen that throughout a lot of his UFC tenure. If you are a very talented boxer on the back foot who can defend a lot of takedowns, well, he is going to have a hard time with you because he can't switch it up and use the other facets of his game. But this fight for Daniel Zellhuber is a very important one, at least for me, because if I was the one making the rankings, or at least in my mind's eye, these are the type of opponents I like prospects to be fighting, right? Yagos has been there.
Like Trey Ogden?
Well, Trey Ogden looked really good, but guess what? His next time out against Lando Venata, who's another wily vet who's been there and done that, like, he looked pretty good in that matchup, and he was able to hurt Lando. I just mean, guys like Lando Venata and Christos Yagos, I think, are the types of opponents that you want prospects to face, because they are well-rounded, they do have holes to their game that are easily recognizable, but if you're able to get a win over types of talent like that, it definitely proves that you deserve a spot in the UFC, and you have a skill set that you can build upon in the future.
The only thing I struggle with, I mean, Daniel Zellhuber, I described him to start the video as Dynamo. The kid's got Maine's favorite soda.
He's got Moxie.
And for Zellhuber, it's kind of like that J. Cole song. He has that awesome fight against Lucas Almeida, loses the first round. It's a fight of the night style, wins the second, wins the third. And then he goes out there against Trey Ogden, and it's like that tune. I ain't never been here before, yo. I ain't never been here before. He had a little bit of stage fright in his first time out. And for Zellhuber, he couldn't get it up against Trey Ogden. So he ends up losing that fight. And it's weird because if you look at Zellhuber just physically, I know he's young, he's 24. He's got, 2 inches in height and 6 inches of reach in this fight. But against Trey Ogden, he kind of got walked down. He couldn't utilize those gifts that he has. And Zellhuber, if you watched him on the regional scene, he could take guys down. He could utilize no-hook jiu-jitsu. No body lock. And that's kind of one of those things, like, Josephine Knudsen can do it when she's fighting unranked women strawweights in her UFC debut, but when you're Daniel Zellhuber and they're giving you a jiu-jitsu black belt in Trey Ogden or Orlando Venata with his wrestling or Christos Yagos, you can't do that. But for Zellhuber's last time out against Venata, in tight, he's able to succeed with his boxing. He lands that big knee. Venata's down, and Jason Herzog Got a move fighter, and he said it a lot, but a lot of the shots hitting the arms, the glove, whatever. But Zellhuber nearly finished Venata in the first round. In the second round, Venata finds himself back into the fight, but Zellhuber, the resolve again in that third round, and he gets a decision. I had it 29-28 that way too. So for Zellhuber in this fight, representing Extreme Couture, Eric Nixick, riding high, he's a big favorite in this one. And we have a look at the Topology votes. Matt, surprised us, say already to you.
I'm really happy for Eric Nixick, by the way. You know, just for a long time was a guy who kind of went behind or under the radar. No one really gave him all the glitz and glamour and stuff, even though he had really great fighters on his roster. So just happy he's getting the recognition he deserves. Side note.
Extreme Couture is today's TriStar MMA. Now, when you look at this one, Matt, again, Zellhuber is favored. We have a look at the Topology votes. Surprised us, say already to you.
I think they'll be closer than the odds would suggest, or are you throwing 90% at me?
I'm going to say over under 80% Zellhuber.
I'll say over. Well, I said under 90, not under 80. Come on.
Yeah, so they're 84%. There's almost 800 votes. 84% Zellhuber. 74% by decision for the 16% that have Yagos. 56% by decision. Give me the underdog, the Spartan Christos Yagos, to get the win. I know it's the unpopular pick in this one, but I think Yagos, with his takedowns, with his forward pressure, he very well could do the old Jamie Malarkey against Muhammad Naimov. Just zombies weigh in. Hands like down, looking for that takedown. Like Sam Alvey against, who was it? Merchant Prakniao against Sam Alvey. But for me, I do like Christos Yagos in this fight. And I do like him to kind of push the pace against Daniel Zellhuber.
I just think everything Yagos does is a little bit too wide. That's it. Like,
kid's
all of
fast
his,
and loose.
He is fast and loose. You know, he's not worried about it. But for Yagos, when he is having success with his strikes, guys who throw straight shots down the middle can always have success against
him. And Zellhuber has a beautiful jab.
He does. And he's also a better striker up close than you'd probably assume looking at him. Yes, he has all those tools at the long range, but he's got better power up close. I was saying, you bring it up. It allows him to throw the threat and the actual knee up. And that's a big weapon for him, a very powerful one at that. So this is what I'll say about this fight. I have Zell Huber to win this one, but I think he's going to look better than he should in this one and lose the next because the UFC is going to be really hyped up about him, if that makes any sense. They'll say, hey, fight David Taymor next, and that might be like a bit of a step too far. You know, I just think for Zell Huber, he's another one of these fighters that if you just want to talk about the strengths, he has all of them. Like, he is a very talented fighter, but there are some weaknesses there that as he starts to develop a higher level of competition, I could see his opponents starting to exploit them, and that's why this Yagos fight's really fun, because Yagos is so well-rounded, so he'll probably have success in at least one area.
If you want to go out there, there are great Twitter threads that are made up by Al Zelino over on, well, Twitter, and he's put out some really good stuff about winners off of Dana White's Contender Series, what their win percentages are. There's been a lot of fighters, so it's not that great. But check that out, Matt. A big-time matchup in this lightweight division. Moving us forward to another heck of a fight once we get to the end of UFC Noche. That title fight up at the top, Grasso taking on Shevchenko. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. This week's What the F*** fight. I don't know if Dana White's going to take that moniker. Like, you know, if you don't know, now you know. But Matt, coming up this weekend on the main card, Raul Rosas Jr. fought on a main card his last time out. He wrestled in the first round against Christian Rodriguez. He gassed. And then in rounds two and rounds three, he got beat up. And he lost that fight to Rodriguez. Now he gets to take on the Alaskan known Tear Bear, Terrence Mitchell. Matt, for Terrence Mitchell, his records moved around. It was 15-2. It was 15-3. Now it's 14-3. A win by disqualification was kind of notched off the record. But if you look at it for Terrence Mitchell, he took a fight on a few weeks' notice last time out against Cameron Simon. Went out there in the first 10 seconds, threw a double leg, got the takedown, and then in the ensuing scrambles and everything that was after it, Simon ended up on top, landing the ground and pound back flat. That was all she wrote. So Terrence Mitchell took that fight. It was back in July. Yeah, so Terrence Mitchell got finished not that long ago. Now, he didn't get cold cocked and knocked out. It was a TKO, but it definitely wasn't a good lasting reminder, though neither one of these guys had good lasting reminders. And if you look at it, Mitchell's last time out was at T-Mobile Arena this weekend. We have a known commodity, a guy that fought on the Ultimate Fighter Season 24 after Brandon Moreno and Alessandro Pantoja in the first episode. It's Terrence Mitchell, the former Alaska FC champ. He was on Dana White's Looking for a Fight. Was it his fault that Nick the Tooth got kicked off that show? Probably not, but so. It was that show where Matt Serra and Nick the Tooth get into that grappling exchange. So if you look at it for Terrence Mitchell, who came in to the Ultimate Fighter, 7-fight win streak, Dana White's Looking for a Fight. And from Looking for a Fight, then he ends up on the show. And that was Tournament of Champions. Everybody was a champ from a regional organization. So Terrence Mitchell in that fight gets to take on the Australian Kai Kara France. Now, on Facebook, 2.9 million views. On YouTube, from a random account with just the highlight, 5.3 million views of Terrence Mitchell mean mugging and putting his fist in Kai Kara France's face in the face-off, only for Terrence Mitchell to get absolutely bodied in 30 seconds. And if you go back and watch that fight, it's just two overhand rights that wobble him the first time. Then it's an overhand left that drops him. Then Terrence Mitchell gets right back up. Overhand right. Good night, Irene, as Michael Schiavello would say. I don't know if he has that trademark, so we got to throw that out there. But Terrence Mitchell, he loses that fight on the Ultimate Fighter in 2016. Now, people are going to say in the co-main event, well, Moreno and Pantoja, that's not a real 2-0, brother, because that one fight was just an exhibition fight. I watched Terrence Mitchell get knocked out, and so did millions of other people. So he took about a year and a half layoff. So 2016 to 2018, he gets a win in 2018, then he takes another long layoff until 2020, and he's been active of late. But when you're fighting in Alaska in the lower weight classes or in general, there's very few Jared Cannoneers, Justin Buchholz. There's a lot more Victor Rodriguez that we saw fight against Adrian Yanez. Terrence Mitchell has been a big fish in a small pond. Now, awesome to see him get this opportunity because when he strikes, he lets it all hang out. And his head kicks are insane. So for Mitchell, at flyweight, I don't know how he made it at 5'10", and they had him on the Ultimate Fighter. 73 and 3/4 is the reach. So overall for Mitchell, really aggressive. but not very good in that one. So now, Matt, we get Terrence Mitchell. He's 33. He's a big guy for bantamweight, and he's taking on Raul Rosas Jr., who we threw up the red flags. We said, listen, this guy's 17, bridging on 18. Listen, we think that he has good conditioning and cardio, but we don't actually know it. We said that every time. And
people thought, did we find out,
people
Craig.
Thought, geez, he's 18. He can just piss in the wind and have as much fun as he wants. But yeah, no. If you haven't gone and ridden a stationary bike or ran a mile, you probably don't have great cardio when it comes to an MMA fight. And poor Raul Rosas Jr. found that out the hard way. So, when it comes down to this fight, Matt, do I have Rosas Jr. to win? Yeah, I do. I'll get that out of the way right now. Because I think he's a powerful grappler. Both these guys can grapple quite
wild.
Well. Mitchell is very fast and loose with it when it does come to
You're
the fight.
You're really on that one.
Getting to the mat. Maybe I'll make it a thing. But for Rosas Jr., very powerful when he does come, and get things down to his preferred spot in an MMA cage. Both these guys strike the same way. Again, it is wildness persona.
But I do think Mitchell's a little bit better with his striking, at least. Like, he's had a lot more time to practice. At
15
least
years?
Yes. Like, a hell of a head start. But for Mitchell, like, there's so many openings there for talented counter-strikers to take advantage of. Could you imagine if Terrence Mitchell had to fight John Lineker? Oh my god. That would be the worst fight of all time, or the best fight of all time, depending on who you choose.
One championship, like to see UFC fighters lose in their promotion.
Exactly. So maybe we could get a rematch of Sage Northcutt versus, what was his name? Cosmo Alessandre. That was a hell of a fight.
Cosmo's retired, though, but yeah.
Cosmo was on some stuff, probably. That's all I'm going to say. My point is, though, Terrence Mitchell is a very wild striker. Like, when he's going to have success, he is going to throw a lot at you, put his foot all the way down to the gas pedal, and just kind of figure it out as he goes. And even if he is having success doing that against a guy like Rosas Jr., it's going to leave the opportunity for Rosas to get in on the hips and have some kind of success with his own grappling. And you're right, Rosas, am I all that sold on him after the last fight? Not at all. But he does at least have a very good foundational skill set, being his grappling, being his BJJ, and it's something that he's proven to be able to go out there and get UFC wins with. So I agree with you. I think he's going to win this matchup, but there's no way in telling what his future is, even if he does beat Terrence Mitchell. He could beat Mitchell in the most dominant 15-minute decision you have ever seen. He could 30-20 the man, and I still wouldn't be all that confident about what Rosas Jr.'s future is.
Yeah, Raul Rosas Jr. is in a category now of prospects like Sage Northcutt got thrown into, or Chase Hooper. You're very good, you're very green, and they have to give you fights, so this is what we get. Matt, Rosas Jr., a big favorite. Stay away from it. We have a look at the topology votes. Stay away from it. I'm going to say over under 80%. Stay away from it. Raul Rosas Jr.
I'm going to say over.
Don't you put it in your mouth. Remember that.
Or you might get sick.
Canadian Concerned Children's Advertisers, if you grew up
they
here in
Canada. They were
looking
out for us.
804 total votes, 89%. Rosas Jr., 76% by decision. For the 11% that are Mitchell, 49% by decision, 22% by submission, 21% by knockout. They don't always shake out to make 100%. Again, I have Rosas Jr. in the fight. I can't offer you up much more than I've offered so far. But yeah. I think it's going to be a highlight reel in somebody's back pocket.
Do you remember? Body break. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Was that the same thing?
Yeah, I mean.
Okay.
Yeah.
The house hippos.
No. Joanne and Hal were doing their own thing. Body break was their own thing. Concerned Canadian Children's Advertisers, the house hippo.
I was very young, as you could tell.
That was something else. 90s ads in Canada. They were
whack.
They were good.
I have Rosas Jr. in this fight. I have no idea what to expect.
It's like that creepy skull drug guy. Like, you want some of these?
Oh, that was terrifying.
That was scary. Make sure you check out the rest of the videos. Co-main event is next. Kevin Holland taking on Jack Della Maddalena. And if you want to take a break, go watch some old Concerned Canadian Children's Advertisers
They're
videos.
Oddly entertaining.
You can spend a couple hours doing that before you come back. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Kraken co-main event coming up at UFC Noche. We have two ranked welterweights duking it out. It's the Trailblazer, Kevin Holland, taking on Jack Della Maddalena. An awesome fight. And for Kevin Holland, his last time out, big time bonus, getting the first round submission win over Michael Chiesa. For Jack Della Maddalena, tested as much as we've ever seen
exactly.
him tested inside of the UFC against Basil Hafez. And people can take that fight six ways to Sunday and tell you who they thought
won. I'm going
to
tell you what happened in this fight because I get a big kick out of it. Jack Della won a fight that people thought was going to be super one-sided. So, everybody thought, hey, he's going to win by first round knockout. Since the fight was, I'll say, kind of close. I gave him a 10-8 in round three.
So did I.
So I thought it was 29-27.
So did I.
Kind of a close fight, I guess, if you lose a round. My point is, it was closer than people expected it to be. So it started this whole conversation of, oh, he lost this fight. Where I just gotta be honest, I don't really see it. I've watched that fight 6 times now, and I've tried to score it as biasedly against Madalena as I possibly can. And I just think that's what the big conversation was coming out of the
exactly.
last match.
Hafez wins the first. The second one round is competitive, but Della ends up getting the win.
In the third.
And then Hafez, having taken the fight on less than a week's notice, he gassed his arms out and everything. His energy systems weren't there, and it was nearly a 10-8 in the third for Della. But when you do consider it, Della just stacking the bonus cash in the bank coming into the UFC off of Contender Series, beating Ange Lusa. And after that Lusa win, beats Pete Rodriguez, and then the bonuses come in, beating Ramazan Ami, performance bonus, Danny Roberts, performance bonus, Randy Brown, performance bonus, and a big, tall, rangy striker similar to Kevin Holland. And now Della is here. And what do we like out of Jack Della? He can get it done in either stance. He can rip it to the body, and he's one of those unique fighters that'll mix that right in to the non-liver side, and it pays against his opponents. So when you look at a guy like Della, obviously we've seen the takedown defense can be an issue. We talked about that even before he was on Contender Series and in the UFC, but now it's a glaring hole, and you're going to see guys looking to exploit that. And for Kevin Holland, again, just his last time out against Chiesa, having success in the striking, I threw up some pictures there getting ready for the Holland-Chiesa fight where Holland's hitting the mitts with Eric Nixick and he's throwing a lot of the uppercuts to the pad. And what does he do to start that fight off?
I just love the thought of you sitting behind your computer like, dude, I've seen something.
30 years of, the show, and that's just all I can think of. But Kevin Holland was going out there hitting Michael Chiesa with the uppercuts. Chiesa goes for the clinch. Holland pushes him down to the mat. And then as the fight continues, Chiesa gets caught in the durs. Holland rolls.
We've seen this story before.
It's the end of the pocket. But if you look at it for Kevin Holland, I mean, some losses to the wrestlers at 185. You look at the losses in the last two, or at least the last two losses that he has. One to Khamzat Chimaev, where he considered retirement. One to Stephen Thompson in a fight of the night where the right hand was broken and he couldn't throw it. And then at the end, he gets finished on the stool. But if you look at a fight like this, Matt, it's gotta be of a little bit of like that Foreigner song, one of your favorites.
Urgent.
Head games! Because for Kevin Holland, his last fight in Vegas, and he's 6-3-1 with an no contest in Las Vegas proper, but his last fight at T-Mobile Arena was in that reshuffled one against Khamzat Chimaev up near the top of the card.
Yeah, so they give him Alexa Grasso. They're like, oh, that weird curveball.
He gets a very interesting one here against Jack Della Maddalena. Again, a wild time for Kevin Holland, the Apex star, but a really hard strength of schedule coming into this one. And these two guys, their styles match up so well to fight each other.
Could Della Maddalena perhaps stop Virgil Hill with a body shot? Oh, y'all must have forgot. I have a really fun time with this fight because I have no idea how it's going to go. And especially in all the areas that both guys are really good at. You rip the takedown defense of Madalena, it is a concerning factor. But what's the one thing everyone's talked about with Kevin Holland? I don't know. For years since he's been fighting anybody good. Start back to the Thiago Santos fight in his UFC debut. The guy has great grappling. Like, his BJJ is very good. He's got great submissions. I do think he does a decent job defensively on the ground. The big problem with Holland is he can get out-muscled by stronger wrestlers when they get that top position, and his takedown defense isn't as good as the rest of his game at this point. Offensively, Kevin Holland is as talented of not only a striker, but an offensive grappler as you will see. He can do a lot once he gets the fight going in his direction, but if he reacts to damage like he did in the Wonderboy Thompson fight in this fight, it's going to be weird. Like, if he's turning his back, kind of walking away, just not reacting well to the strikes that Madalena can land on him, Jack Della Maddalena is a really heavy-handed striker. And I know Kevin Holland had a broken hand in that fight. Like, he was going through quite a bit, but still, he was getting hit by shots and rocked on the feet. And if he gets into that same position against a guy like Della Maddalena, it might not be as, not that he didn't get stopped by Wonderboy Thompson, but he could get finished soon after.
So I'm not throwing the graphics up there this time, but I'll mention it. Holland breaks the hand against Wonderboy. Seems like it's still healing. He fights Santiago Ponzinibbio, wins first round, wins second round. In the third round, Ponzinibbio is a rallying, and Holland is jabbing and kicking his way to a win. He's not throwing the right hand. You see the finishing sequence? What does he do? Right hand,
crack.
Left hand, and it's over. That was pretty well the only solid right hand that Holland landed in that Ponzinibbio fight. And that's why I mentioned he was throwing it as an uppercut and he was throwing it against Chiesa. So hopefully it's doing better. It seems like it's doing better, but I don't know that because I'm not Kevin Holland. So when I look at this fight, Matt, for Della, he's got things to pick up on to where he could have success. When you crowd Kevin Holland, sometimes there's a pullback with no counter and you're able to land against him. Sometimes he gets caught behind the black lines, and then he can be a sitting duck, or he does have good movement laterally.
Shots down the middle like an MF or two.
Kevin Holland has really good movement, but sometimes he will kind of get himself caught against the fence, freeze, and yes, his jabs and his straights are very good, but that's to where Della can start to attack the body, attack the head. The thing that I hate about this is it's a fight night with a title in the main event. It's at a big arena with a lot of fans. Robbie Lawler, Nick Diaz was 5 rounds. I don't understand this why this be. Isn't 5 rounds.
That's a great
rounds.
Point.
But when I look at this matchup, Matt, for Della, I'll be interested to see. I mean, he's gone out there against a good puncher, gone tit for tat, and come out on the winning end in Ange Lusa. And we've seen how good Lusa has been since that point. So I also have a hard time making a pick on this one. I can preview it till the end of days.
This is the fight that I went back to, though, and I think it told me the most out of both guys and their fighting style. I think Kevin Holland is going to look like he did against McCain Buckley. And I know
so
Buckley made his debut against Kevin Holland in that matchup. So, listen, it was on short notice. But guess what? McCain Buckley's a good fighter. He might not be top 15. He might not be ranked any time in his career. But I think we all know that he's not a bad fighter by any means. And what does he do? He puts his hands up. He moves his head left to right. Gets very low. And then responds with boxing combinations and blitzes. Maddalena puts his hands up. Doesn't get nearly as low. But still, you get the idea. Marches forward. Uses a lot of those boxing combinations. If he can crowd the distance so much that Kevin Holland just almost overreaches when he does try to land his shots, then okay, Maddalena's gonna be able to win this fight. But I think Holland's gonna hit him with counter shots down the middle on the way in that's really gonna keep him from just standing in that pocket without anything coming back his way. So I feel like a lot of people would be surprised that I'm not picking Maddalena in this fight, but I do have Kevin Holland. I just think the way he strikes is gonna be a good counter for what Maddalena tries to do.
It was announced today, the Marcel Dorf bomb, it's like a Woj bomb, that Joaquin Buckley's going to be fighting another Texan fighter, a guy who loves to commentate MMA fights. It's Alex Morono, so look out for that welterweight fight.
A fight that makes me happier than it should.
Joaquin Buckley, I also went back and watched that fight, and for that reason, I have Kevin Holland. Now, you shouldn't just base it off of one fight. Go back and watch fights and make your own approximations, but Holland a slight favorite. The odds are very, very close. We have a look over in Topology. I'm going to say over under 65% Holland?
I think they'll be under. I think Maddalena will be the favorite.
Oh boy, yeah. Yeah, 844 total votes, 55% Maddalena, 44% by decision, 49% by knockout. For the 45% that have Holland, 40% by decision, 27% by submission, 28% by knockout. Would it surprise you if Holland pulled his game plan like he did against Alex Oliveira, struggling a little bit with the strikes? Get her down to the mat, bud.
This is my problem with Kevin Holland. When he does decide to use his own grappling, this is my thing with any guy who is a primary striker. I know Holland's a grappler, but still, you get the idea. His wrestling isn't at the forefront of his game. When you go from your primary skill set to your secondary skill set and try to flip it up all of a sudden, you're going to leave holes and openings to the people who primarily use that as their skill set, be it the wrestling for Kevin Holland, just aren't going to leave. And for Holland, he will get really long on some of his takedown attempts. He will leave himself exposed. And if he does decide to do that and leave his head in the wrong place, Maddalena has insane power up close. And if Holland is leaning on him, trying to get the takedown in one of those awkward positions up against the cage, I think Maddalena can make him pay for it. So that's why I do think Holland's going to be hesitant to go out and wrestle a lot. But if he hurts Maddalena with a shot, I don't think he's going to try to finish him up with ground and pound. I think we will see Kevin Holland switch to that grappling mode and try to get the win via sub.
And you've seen Della be able to get the win, especially against Ramazan Ameev. Gets taken down early, pops back up, Bob's your uncle, sends him down like a sack of potatoes. We are in agreement on this one, but not with the fans. Both of us going with Trailblazer Kevin Holland to get the win. Let us know who you have. Please, down below in that comment section, toss a like and we move it forward. Title fight in the rematch in the main event. Alexa Grasso taking on Valentina Shevchenko. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
UFC Noche main event, a big time fight, the title fight rematch between a future Hall of Famer, Bullet Valentina Shevchenko, taking on the rising Mexican star, Alexa Grasso. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, X and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Tyreek Hill super fan.
Oh, he's good.
At Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, when we look at it, we're excited because The Browns and the Dolphins won today. If you didn't guess, we're football fans for sure. But what we can be fans of is this rematch. Matt, Valentina Shevchenko in the original matchup, a big favorite. You go back and you watch the fight, you dissect it. The first round, Grasso looks amazing, switching her stances, working from southpaw, landing some big strikes. In the second and third round, Shevchenko getting the takedowns, at one point getting her in almost the mounted crucifix position, landing some good ground and pound. But at the end of the third round, the takedowns getting a little bit more labored. And then we get into the fourth round, Shevchenko, she's like a whirling dervish, like Merab Abdullahashvili, just going for the spinning shot. And out of the spin, she gives her back and hangs out.
Weidman with the Spider-Man meme.
Hangs out for just a hair too long of a split second. Grasso rushes to get the back. Is able to kind of disable her opponent, get the trip. And then Grasso on the back gets her a naked choke. And just like when you're making pickles, Matt, did you hear the pop on the jar? Yeah, we heard that pop. She was able to get that submission win. So Shevchenko's face, two different colors out of that submission, and the belt is gone. Now, when you look at it traditionally in MMA, especially in the UFC, when you have these title fight rematches, you don't always see the fighter that was the champ go on to win the belt in the rematch. We have seen it recently, though. We saw it with, well, Israel Adesanya when he fought Alex Pereira. And you saw it with Amanda Nunes when she fought Pena in their second matchups. But by and large, it doesn't happen very often. So when it comes down to this matchup, Matt, Shevchenko taking on Grasso. Grasso's 1-1-1 some more. We know that she struggles with the takedowns, although fans will say, well, Grasso's the better grappler. Grasso's going to get the takedown.
Wait,
the submission.
I want to meet these fans. Just because you have a submission win over somebody doesn't mean that you're automatically the better grappler.
Get ready to read our comments.
Oh, don't worry.
When you do look at this, we've seen Grasso struggle against Barber, struggle against Esparza with the takedowns. But when it's on the feet, she can succeed. However, again, even round two, round three in their original matchup, Shevchenko was winning in those striking exchanges in those two rounds. Because even though Grasso had that success from southpaw in the first round, she left herself out there, kept her feet back, and overextended on her shots. That not only gave Shevchenko a window to counter, it also opened up all of those easier double legs that Shevchenko was able to land. So we'll see where things play out in this matchup. Again, Grasso training in her native Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico, which I mentioned earlier, 1,566 meters above sea level. Shevchenko, she moves around gyms every time, but training close to Vegas for this one. So you look at the fight, Matt. I think, again, another awesome fight. I'm glad it's another title fight in a main event. The last time you had a title fight in a fight night main event, it was Figueiredo Benavidez 2, and it wasn't even close. So hopefully this one's a little bit closer than that. But I know you're excited about this rematch, and I think it's one that's warranted because you're talking in that high air of esteem where we're talking about a future Hall of Famer. But they did that before Adesanya versus Strickland. They did that before Sterling versus O'Malley. They were given those GOAT statuses out there. So we'll see how this one plays out.
This is and I jump on you every time you say this. They is the promoter of the company, Dana White. And guess what the promoter's going to do? Promote his fighters and say the current ones are the greatest ones ever. So yeah.
If you don't know, now you know.
That conversation's always going to be out there. I'm going to start my part off saying one of the dumbest things I've ever said, but I will defend it. This fight is one where either the champion's going to look great and retain or the challenger's going to win. And you're probably saying, well, yeah, no shit, Matt. Those are the only two results you could possibly have in a title fight. But please allow me to explain. For a lot of these title rematches, you're right. Normally, the champion retains and looks great. They just shut the door on the former champion who is trying to make that one last hurrah in the top, not only 15, but just in that title picture. Or the former champion comes in and kind of has one of those y'all must have forgot performances and maybe even gets a finish. And I could see that being the opportunity in this fight, especially if Shevchenko does go for a lot of double leg takedowns because her ground and pound is so good from that top position. And the thing about Grasso is she can't get back up to her feet in the majority of her fights.
Wow!
She goes for a full guard in a lot of matchups.
In that crucifix position that Shevchenko had where you think, okay, Valentina's finished a title fight in this manner, what could happen? Grasso was able to get herself out and back up.
You are correct, but those are positions that leave a lot of wiggle room. That's why people don't use full mount as much as they use half guard, because half guard gives you more control. You're right, crucifix is a dominant position you can get great ground and pound from, but it also gives the opponent a lot of room to at least buck and try to create separation. And yes, Alexa Grasso can do those things, but when she's in those set positions on the mat, she does have a difficult time getting back up to her feet, and she can get her butt caught up against the cage and her back caught up against the cage, and that's a position that Shevchenko can do very well Ellen. She likes that wrist control to pull her opponent back down to the ground. But we talked about this a little bit before we even went on air. Shevchenko's fights were starting to get closer, though, before she did give up the title. It's not like she was the same dominant champion who was going out there getting doctor stoppages and TKOs and head-kicking Jessica Ai. Her fights started going not only to decision, but they started getting close by the time that they were done, and they started asking, or they started having you asking, hey, like, is she still the great that she once was? And Shevchenko's the greatest fighter in this weight class's history, no matter what. Probably, a top five women's fighter of all time, yeah. Probably. It's a very short list, whoever's in front of her.
Ronda, Cyborg, Nunes, Ronda, Shevchenko.
Holly.
Yeah.
There, I'd say that's a very sound top five.
Or so, a strawweight, maybe Zhang Weili's up there.
There you go. Either way, though, she is probably in that top five category, and that's why this rematch is more than justified. I just think on the feet, she is going to continue to have a little bit of trouble. We haven't seen her have that same killer instinct of, hey, I'm going to stand there, bop in the pocket, and then counter with my own shots. She'll move out of the way a lot more often than just try to counter and then respond with her own offense. And I think that if she does do that, kind of gets behind in the significant strike numbers, it's going to be a lot for her to make up in those championship rounds. But even though we haven't seen Grasso in those fourth and fifth rounds nearly as often as we have Shevchenko by any means, Grasso does have great output and great cardio and a very steady gas tank too.
Yeah, Grasso, it was weird. I mean, 87 to 59 are the significant strikes through three and a bit rounds. When you do look at it, it was a fourth round stoppage win for Grasso, who is the champ. Shevchenko was doing a decent job of counter-striking on the outside, getting backed up round two, round three. She did land a lot of those shots once it was on the mat as well. But when you look at somebody like Grasso, she had all that success in the world in Southpaw at the start. You have to think Shevchenko, along with Pavel and Antonina,
the dream team.
They've been training that a little bit. And when you do look at a fight like this, again, Grasso's one of those fighters, it's going to be really interesting. And you heard Daniel Cormier say this. I found this really, really interesting. He said something to the effect of, your challenger, they're always bringing the best to the fight. When you're the champion, you're always facing the best version of that challenger. And I thought, except Alexa Grasso's teammate, Irina Aldana, looked terrible against
Amanda Nunes. But they also say Nunes. The champion gains 30% when they win the title because it's a newfound confidence in your skill set. So it does go both
ways. Yeah, I thought, hey, I don't know about that. But when you do watch Grasso have all that success, tagging Shevchenko, even from Southpaw, landing the right hook, doing really good work, Shevchenko, the one thing that I noticed in that fight, and I've noticed in these last three fights, Jennifer Maia gets taken down in one round, loses one of those rounds, and then in the fight against Tyler Santos, back and forth, 50-50 split decision, though most thought that Shevchenko had won. If you do look at it, Shevchenko started to back up a little bit more on the straight line, not cut angles as much, be willing to stand in the pocket, but also get tagged in those situations. So when you do look at this matchup, Matt, Shevchenko is slightly favored in the fight. I'd like to hear from
you. The Ioana fight was a precursor to that. No one's going to remember this because she beat Ioana like 50-44, 50-45. Like, she beat her mostly every single round. But in the fourth round of that matchup, Ioana was moving forward. She clipped Shevchenko with a head kick that I'm not going to sit here and tell you it stunned her like crazy, but still, they were solid strikes that we didn't see Shevchenko not be the same fighter on the retreat as she is moving forward. And you're right, I agree 100%. She doesn't move just enough out of the way of shots to respond to their own offense. Now she will just evade the pocket completely sometimes, and that'll be concerning if she has that same game plan.
And it will be. He had Korean Zombie a few weeks ago, 10 straight main events, retires after he fights Max Holloway. 10 straight title fights. For Israel Adesanya, lose the belt to Sean Strickland. You see a theme
never
here?
Never thought you'd say those words, did you?
Valentina Shevchenko loses to Nunes, UFC 215 at Bantamweight for the Bantamweight title. Fights Priscilla Cachoeira instead of fighting Nico Montano. That one was not a title fight main event.
Close.
And since then, Shevchenko's fought in 10 straight title fight main events. So when it does come down to this one, we throw it out to you folks. YouTube community tab, almost 1,000 votes. 55% going with Valentina Shevchenko to win in the rematch. The comments here, Matt, here we go. Chandler Witt, he's out there every week.
He is.
Responding
Shout
to these
out.
Comments. I think Grasso takes it again. Maybe a decision this time, kind of like Leon versus Usman. Valentina's getting old, and I think she's been figured out. We got Kent Fitzsimmons saying Grassi takes it by sub or decision.
They're like best friends.
We've got Praduman 1000 saying Alexa Grasso is going to be more dominant this time around. Shevchenko has issues on the ground with multiple fighters, and I think Grasso is going to take her down and get a unanimous decision win. And we got Bill Cipher. This fight is rebound or retire for Shevchenko.
Very well could be.
Grasso made her look like a bum in that fight. That back take at the end, submission came way too easy. Hopefully, whatever back alley gym Shevchenko trains at basic ground defense this time.
That's a funny comment.
Okay, any comment, a lot of the comments I've seen, a lot of the stuff I've seen on Twitter completely disregards the entire fight, and everybody just looked at the result. And I mentioned this earlier on this card. Headline readers. You don't go out and you read your news. You just read the headlines and you take that with you in your day because you might have a fun fact and you don't care to learn about the world. Watch the fights.
You're so mad at these imaginary people.
Watch the fights. It's every week with this bullshit. Matt, I have a hard time picking the fight because Grasso looked great with the striking in the first round. And then the wheels fell off in the second and third round, so to speak, because she overextended on shots and got taken down. And then in a moment of flurry where Shevchenko was doing a spinning shot, she got taken down, got her back taken in that second, and then got herself submitted and wasn't able to get out of that choke whatsoever. Could barely even fight it.
I'm glad one of our commenters did bring up the second Leon Edwards-Usman fight, because I do think that's a fight that you are going to learn a little bit from, right? It was a rematch that a lot of people felt was a fluke win the first time around, right? Usman was so dominant up until that ending, and then Leon Edwards lands the head kick out of nowhere. And for Grasso, it's not like this fight was as one-sided as that one was, but things weren't trending in the right direction for her up until she was able to take the back off of Shevchenko. But I do feel like Grasso is firmly in her prime right now, and I do think that we have seen her get better every single performance in and out, and we haven't seen that regression out of her just yet. So could Shevchenko go out there, put on the wrestling shoes, have a great top position, that top pressure, and be able to win this fight? I think she could, but I do think Grasso's going to be able to use that movement to really evade some of those takedowns of someone like Shevchenko.
I honestly have a hard time, and the more and more you go back and you watch some of these fights, Shevchenko just dusting everybody until she faces Jennifer Maia, and then there's a little bit of a chink in the armor. Then she goes out there and she's taking on Tyla Santos, and it gets a little bit closer. And even though Santos lost her last fight, usually those title challengers that lose and then take a lot of time off tend to lose again after that. And she did lose to a really good fighter in Erin Blanchfield after winning the first round. So when I come back to this fight, yeah, I got Valentina Shevchenko to win it. Again, I like what I saw in the second round and the third round. Obviously, you like the stick-to-itiveness of Grasso to step on the pedal in that fourth round to go out there and get the finish and win the belt and so on and so forth. But for me, I like Shevchenko with the takedowns. I think she can dictate those takedowns a little bit more. We'll see if the conditioning and the cardio are able to play out for Shevchenko, because it looked like she was starting to tire in the second round, in the third round, carried that over into the fourth round. And again, she's not, by saying she's not a spring chicken, she's 35 and 6 months old or so.
She's been fighting since she was like Tapology. 14,
though. Yeah, she's been fighting since the early 2000s, if not earlier. So it's been a long and storied career for Valentina Shevchenko. So we are split on the pick in this one.
I hope we get one of the great crowd pops of all time for Alexa Grasso, though. I really do. Like, on Independence Day for Mexico, like,
in
she
Las
is
Vegas,
a Mexican champion.
Yeah.
But still, like, it's just those types of atmospheres that you really hope are set up to really justify this fighter and this champion. I saw the UFC gave her one of those cool belts like they gave Yair Rodriguez leading up to his title fighter unification.
That's up to the winner in this one, is it not?
What?
They get that cool, like, bedazzled belt.
I'm taking that. The one for Grasso looked pretty cool. So I think I just like the fact that they are starting to market, and hopefully we will see this, the more, like, individuality of the fighters, because it helps them a lot more promote themselves. So for Grasso, I like the cool belt. That has nothing to do with the fact that I think she's going to win this weekend. I just like the movement and the fact that, again, I think her movement not only can help her evade some of the strikes of Shevchenko, it's going to help her stay out of the way of some of the wrestling offense.
Only 11 fights on this card as of Sunday when we tape it. If anything changes, you can find more here at Fight Night Picks. Make sure you subscribe and keep it tuned in for all of that. 2 hours before the prelims, we have the show Question Mark Kicks. We offer up those final thoughts, previews, and predictions, and we get to talk about the week that was. If there's any weight misses or anything goes squirrely, you can always find us here at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP. You're going to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.